you know any places any Sega nerds hang out around here?
Welcome to the Sega Nerdcast, episode 81. I am Chris, the editor of Sega Nerds, and with me this week is Blake.
How's it going, everybody?
Hey there. And we also have Stephen Frost. How's it going, man?
Good. How are you guys?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad.
It's good to have you back on, Stephen.
It's been a while since we've had you on the show, eh?
Yeah, I mean, a lot has happened. I always enjoy the doing these. It's always tough that, like, I wish I could do them all the time, you know what I mean? Just, like, because I listen to you guys, on my commute or on our public transportation and stuff like that. Uh-huh. There's a couple podcasts that I kind of cycle through, and it's, it's just fun hearing you guys chit-chat and stuff. And I miss that sometimes, like, jumping off the thing. It's like back in the old days, especially when I was doing the editorial stuff in the magazine side, it was fun just to sit around with people in a room with people and just talk about games. It's tough. Ironically, it's kind of tough to do that. You know, you work at a place like Sega, but it's also very business oriented, and the product development group talks about games, but still you don't really have time to just sit there, put your feet up and just chit chat about, like, you know, what games you're playing and, you know, what you've sort of done recently in games and things like that. So it's I sort of miss those days, which is why I love hearing podcasts like the Nerdcast, where you guys kind of just chit chat and have fun, you know. So
yeah, I would imagine that being at work at a big developer like Sega, it would be talk on video games from a completely different perspective. Like, it would mainly focus, like, on the business aspect and like you said, not really talk about, like, what people are enjoying and what they're playing and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a lot. Obviously there's the game stuff, but there's lots of, like, you know, number looking, you know, analyzing number stuff and talking about numbers and doing presentations and presenting stuff. And, you know, because there's so many different groups. That's most of our thing. Like, you know, you're trying to update PR and marketing, the executives and, you know, the licensing group and everyone else about this stuff who have sort of been removed from the project. So you're repeating the sort of the same stuff over and over again. So it's kind of a different type of game discussion.
That doesn't actually sound all that much fun all the time.
Unfortunately, game development is a business, and while there are definitely fun parts, it's just like everything else. It can be very, you know, those days where you're just very frustrated and angry, and you're just like, I can't believe I'm doing this. And but, you know, in the end, you just have to remember that you're trying to create entertainment for people, right? So
right. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Well, why don't we just kind of go around the room and see what everyone's been up to. Steven, since you're our guest, how about you start and just tell us what you've been up to this past week and so.
So, obviously I have a fair bit of free time now. My last day at Sega was almost 2 weeks ago exactly. So I have sort of been getting accustomed to the free time at home and still trying to do a little bit of productive stuff every day. And not be, you know, that guy who sleeps in all day long and just, you know, watches TV and stuff. Like, I get a little antsy. So I kind of try to do a little bit of each thing and kind of move on and actually try to choose at least one or two productive things that I can accomplish on the day that I wouldn't normally want to do it. So, it's been good. I have been playing a fair number of games, though. Destiny still takes up most of my time. Like, we have a clan at Sega, there's always people on every day. We have probably like 10 or 11 people in our group, and so there's always at least 5 or 6 that are on every day, especially every night. So we end up playing an average of probably like 2 or 3 hours every night, regardless. Even though we have, you know, even though we have issues with the game and we hate aspects of the game, mm-hmm. I think that the fact that Destiny is most fun when you're playing with your friends. So that's what I think keeps us going and playing it over and over again. But I've been playing some other stuff too. Like, I was playing I think it's called Valiant Hearts, that Ubisoft game where...
Oh, that's the PS Plus game that was released, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it uses the Rayman, the UbiArt engine. And it's pretty interesting. It's actually, I mean, the gameplay, I don't know if you've played it.
I started playing it this past week.
Yeah, I mean, the gameplay is pretty straightforward, but they're trying to do sort of an emotional story to kind of drive it along a little bit. So it's kind of interesting, kind of an interesting experience. I am trying to kind of play more of Dragon Age Inquisition.
Oh, man, I'm afraid of that game.
Yeah, it's tough because I'm only doing it in digestible chunks, which is really hard because it's kind of a big game, right? It's like 100-plus hour sort of experience, and it's really tough to do RPGs in short bursts. But I'm trying to do that. And then I'm kind of going back and jumping around and playing a lot of the classic kind of games, old school days. I'm playing a lot more like Sega CD stuff now and trying to do 32-bit stuff and things like that. So, do you want to show like what we have kind of gotten recently now, or do you want to?
Yeah, let's do. Yeah, we could go do pickups and stuff at the end. That's awesome. I always love to see those.
So, I haven't really bought that much, but just through virtue of like Sega and the whole sort of transitioning and downsizing and stuff like that, there's been a lot of stuff that Sega has been clearing out, which I think most people, if they'd seen it, probably would blow their minds as far as the stuff. So I was like this happy kid, and I'm running around, and people don't know why I'm so excited. And if you remember, I was taking pictures, every couple days of just a bunch of random stuff, right? And that's just a small percentage of the stuff that was out there. Because between like the licensing and the PR and just our storage closets and stuff like that, there was so much stuff. And it was so exciting. So I managed to have – I probably ended up walking out of there with probably like 15 boxes of stuff or something like that.
Oh, my gosh.
And he's giving it all away today on the Nerdcast.
Yeah. but it's stuff that like people, who that would be a huge huge giveaway. It's stuff that most people who, aren't really into the old school games who wouldn't necessarily appreciate or want. Like I picked up like, five like AC adapters for like the Genesis and the 32X, things that like may break down in the future. And like tons of like six button controllers and Knights.
Were they still all boxed up and everything?
Yeah, they're either like boxed up or they're like in just like the plastic bags, like sealed like plastic bags.
That's awesome.
So it's just everything from like hardware and things like that, and they're keeping obviously like an archive. They still keep a lot of that stuff to protect it, and some of it will go back to Japan, some will be stored, but tons of duplicates of stuff that that they said, well, let the employees kind of have it. And there's a lot of stuff that I wanted to try to keep for like nostalgia's sake and just to protect it and things. So I grabbed as much as I can, but there's only so much that I as a singular person can grab. So I tried to give it to some of the other people who are really big Sega fans and just people who used to work, like Aaron Weber. I told Aaron would come back so I could give him some of the old school stuff, especially the Sonic stuff, like the old Sonic calendars and banners. I found like old school, like vinyl, big, high quality banners for like Unleashed and things like that. So there's one for the Werehog and one for Sonic and stuff, and old school like Dreamcast era, like the launch posters for Jet Set and things like that, and Skies of Arcadia.
I would be all over that stuff.
Yeah,
that
so there's an amazing amount of stuff. But some of the stuff I got out of there, I mean, there's huge number of boxes of stuff. But like, ironically, one of the things I found there, which is not even a Sega, it's a Sega platform, but it's. I've shown this stuff before in the past, but I'm a big Primal Rage fan, and I found like a sealed copy of 32X Primal Rage.
Oh,
wow. So this is the
that
last.
Is awesome.
This is the last Primal Rage to add to my collection. So now I have like basically every version, a home version of it. So that's pretty cool.
That is awesome.
I bought a bunch of like Sega CD and stuff, but the one that I actually hadn't played before that I got the boxes kind of beat up is Tempo, which is this platformer.
We were just talking about that earlier in the week.
Were you? Yeah. Were you? Yeah. So I found it at the bottom of this box, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I've never played that. I remembered it, but I never played it. But this game, the menu to actually start the game is very cumbersome. Like, it took me like 5 minutes to figure out actually how to start the game. You're on this elevator that goes up and down, and there's only a set number of options, and I don't know which one was to actually start the game. It's really weird. I'm like, that's so badly designed.
That's terrible.
But Tempo. So I had a bunch of 32X games that I added to my collection. That was sort of one of them.
A lot of people online were saying when Sega announced Tembo, the badass elephant, They're saying, yeah. "Hey, don't forget about Tempo though. Where's the new next Tempo game?" So
yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's one of the ones that I missed totally when I was a younger guy, and I never ever played that. So I was glad to sort of find that. And then I got just miscellaneous stuff like these things that you know you don't see very often, like the Netlink Game Pack, which had Virtualon and Sega Rally. And it's less about like the games itself, but just more like things that well you don't see this that often, right?
It's that's it's the stuff I love. Yeah, absolutely. That is amazing.
So this is the stuff that I grabbed. And then the stuff that I've sort of been playing, I've been playing a lot of games, but some of the stuff I've been playing on specifically recently over the last couple days is Fahrenheit for this.
Yes, I want that one.
Which looks, I don't know if you've seen the difference, you probably have because you have both, but like the difference in video quality between a regular Sega CD game and a Sega 32X CD game.
I have a couple of the combo games.
It's amazingly different. It's like the Sega CD 32X games are actually watchable. Like it's a huge jump in quality. It's amazing. Mm-hmm.
I should have that one, but I'm missing disc one, so it won't work at all.
Oh yeah, you have to put in the unfortunately you have to put in the first disc before you can do the third. It's stupid because it boots up for a second. It doesn't even load the game. It just boots up and it says okay.
Insert take out the second disc.
Insert second disc. Yeah. It's like really just weirdly designed. But I was shocked because I couldn't remember. This was like the because I hadn't had any Sega 32X CD games for in recent memory and. So when I popped it in, I was comparing. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like huge, like difference, utilizing like the extra processors, the SH2 processors in the 32X. And then the other one that I'm playing is Adventures of Batman and Robin.
Oh sweet.
Which is a surprisingly a hard game. I kind of tweeted about this previously, but like some of those overall, I think like the Sega CD games are pretty hard. Like just the base level of them is pretty hard. Like this game, it starts out with the Batmobile, and you know you think after all these years of gaming, you're like playing, you're like I at least can get through the first few stages like no problem. Like it's you're basically in the Batmobile and you're racing through traffic and you can't hit the other cars because they're regular people. And so you're trying to race under time, and if you hit
Batman
the cars,
Batman doesn't kill people, right?
So. Yeah, but it's like if you hit the cars too much, then you start over. And there's many situations where the cars are so close that you can't pass by. It's like really hard. And so I'm like, I died like 5 times, like doing it. Right? I'm like, this is insane. So
Is that the one that it's all basically in the Batmobile? That one?
Yeah, there's two. It's like a Batmobile is the most of it, and then there's like these sort of side like flying. Sort of sequences, gliding sequences, but yeah, a good chunk of it is driving, and also like the tank or something, or what is it? The Batwing.
I was gonna say the Batmo tank.
The Batwing. So that was one of the ones that I started playing. It's like it's a weird game because it's so vehicle based. It's very interesting. So
I do remember that there were codes for that. I don't remember what it was. But there's some way to like select levels or skip levels or something. So if you just want to see the game, especially if you just want to see those cinematics in the game because they're so great, then you should be able to find those online, I'm sure.
I want to do that. So I'm getting more into the Sega CD stuff. I wanted to get the now they had the reissue. This is awesome, but the what's that RPG called for the Genesis set? They did a Kickstarter and they released it for Dreamcast too.
Pierre Solar.
Yeah, Pierre Solar. That they have a cartridge. Original soundtrack CD that basically you play the cartridge in and then you can put the Sega CD and it'll play the music off of the Sega CD.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah,
it's like, but the reissue is super expensive. It's good, like with the two of them, it's like over $100-something or something like that. Oh, I really want to get that, but it's like, why not just buy, I guess, the Dreamcast version, right?
It depends on kind of what you want. If you just want the like ease of use, there's always it's on PS4, it's pretty much on all the new systems. You
now,
can just get
it
on there, and it's neat because you can also switch back between like the retro graphics and even the old sound chips and stuff too. So if you want like the newest versions of the music, it's going to be the highest quality and everything. You can select that, or you can go back to like the Genesis era, like music and stuff built for that sound chip and everything. So
that's really cool. That's like some of the stuff that they, you know, switching between different audio systems is like the we'll talk about it later, but the Sega 3D Classic stuff, which is amazing. Yeah. You know? So, but yeah, that's I mean, I've been basically going through the boxes and sorting them and you know, doing videos about stuff. I've started like a YouTube video channel, which I thought I would do as a productive thing to try to accomplish, you know, on a daily basis, and just getting my feet wet on some of that stuff.
Cool. What's it called?
It's just Frostman007. It's youtube.com/Frostman007. So I am posting videos on every couple days about doing different unboxings of old Sega stuff, just talking about the industry as a whole and just Sega memories and things. So just learning about YouTubing in general and just trying to, like, have a dialogue with the community still and fans and stuff like that. So hopefully I can continue to keep doing that and think of other ways that I can kind of share information and some of the stuff that I have here at the house and things like that. So it's fun. It's been pretty cool so far. I've been getting a pretty good positive reception. So hopefully I can continue that and just keep sharing, you know, more and more stuff with everyone out there.
Oh my gosh, you have an unboxing some sort of N-Gage product on your page?
Yeah, it's the original N-Gage, because I got one of those, and you know, Sega ironically was one of the biggest supporters of the original N-Gage.
Yeah.
We had like six games for it, which is shocking. No one even had like remotely that many games. And so I always wanted one, and I got it. So I did an unboxing of it just for those who, you know, were not aware of it, or like just it kind of slipped by them. And they
was one of the biggest N-Gage fans, and I actually used it as my primary phone.
Are you serious?
I had to.
Yeah,
I am dead serious. I promise. Yeah. My wife will actually. Oh, that's so amazing. My wife will back me up on that. But I remember I had the original N-Gage, the one that you did the unboxing of.
Yeah, that one.
That was the taco phone that everyone made fun of. They came out with a revised one called the QD, which enabled you to talk like a normal phone, and then also you didn't have to remove the battery to put a new game in like you do that version.
Yeah, for those who don't know, this is the game cartridge slot that goes in, and the battery is right here. So you have to actually, every time you change a game, you have to take off the battery case, you have to remove the battery, and then you have to slide in the new game. So it's a little bit ridiculous, but.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed with Nokia being, you know, at the time, probably the world's biggest, you know, cell phone manufacturer would kind of make a bonehead decision to do something like that. It was just not very user-friendly. I mean, I didn't mind it too much. I also tell people that the N-Gage is the only handheld system of all time to ever get an Elder Scrolls game on it. No other system has ever gotten that. It has an Elder Scrolls game. So.
That is a good point. It has some crazy games on there, like Red Faction and things like that. And you know, and they had some interesting, like, they were trying to think about stuff. They had, like, the headphone cord had an antenna, and you could, like, upload video clips and stuff, and in some ways, it was way ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
But in other ways, they kind of dropped the ball and kind of did things in a really weird way that wasn't very intuitive. And I just think that, you know, I know they have a lot, but like you present this to someone, you're like, oh my God, there's so many buttons, right? And navigating,
oh, it's so awesome.
And navigating like the menu system is very like difficult just to do simple stuff. So it's like, you know, it's you know, like some good things and some bad things. And I was saying on my video, but when they gave up on the N-Gage and they went to a sort of a development platform, they basically the location of it was at the old Sega building in Sega that we used to be at in Townsend. We were there at the same time as them. So when they were transitioning to a software platform, what is it called? N-Gage 2.0 or whatever it was, we were there as well, and then saw them cut down, and then we ended up moving to another location. But it was just kind of funny how close in proximity we were during that
time. That's crazy.
So, yeah.
I took my N-Gage with me to Iraq when I deployed to Iraq. I had mine, but I used it for everything. I actually read the entire Ender's Game book on there. I uploaded like e-books on it. I read Ender's Game, I read Ender's Shadow on it, and a few other books. I would just stay up reading it and look at this whole thing. I use it for everything. It was great.
That's crazy. Speaking of reading, actually would have been useful. They have this, because I have one of the, I'm not wearing, but one of the Android Wear watches, and there's a program that basically you can read a book on it, and it shows you one word at a time every, like, couple seconds, or a second or so. Just, it's like this, they've, like, sort of calculated how long it takes for a person to read a word, and you can adjust it, but basically you're reading a story one word at a time, and instead of, like, moving your eyes across the page, it just does one word after another after another. It's very interesting.
That's crazy.
That reminds me of an old SNL skit with Phil Hartman, and everyone's going to think I'm really old when I think about it. They had a virtual reality headset on.
Yeah.
And he was looking around his virtual living room, and he had a lamp on a desk, and he had a book, and if he picked up the book, it was Moby Dick, and he would turn the page, and it would have one word on each page. So it was so fixated. Call me, and then he turned the page again.
Yeah.
Email, and then he turned the page again. It reminds me of that, anyway.
Yeah, that's funny. That's funny. Anyway, but that is the only other interesting purchase, and I get more and more of these, but these things were, it looks like a USB drive, but actually it's a has a Wi-Fi in it too, so you can stream stuff to your like computer or iPad or phone or anything like that. So it's like a little like USB drive, and I have a bigger one too. It's like, I think this one's like 64 gigs. And what you do is you put your movies on here, and then you turn it on, and then you can connect to it like a Wi-Fi network. And then you could just stream audio or movies off of it up to like five people, I think, four or five people can do it at one time. So it's really useful on trips.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really useful on trips and stuff like that. So there's a couple different versions of this, ones that are bigger that look kind of like smaller hard drives and things like that. And they have SD card slots. But I like this one because it's so small, and the range is pretty good on it too. So like on airplanes and things like that, you can just turn it on and have, you know, whatever, watch 20 hours of movies or something. But
What is that product called?
This one is the SanDisk. I think it's called a wireless flash drive. I think this one is called. And they have one that looks kind of like a squarish hockey puck too, that has an SD card slot that has, I think, a little bit better battery life and a larger capacity. But this is their cheapest one from SanDisk. So it's pretty cool for those who want to take movies on the go and have an iPad or an Android tablet or phone or something. There's an app that basically runs, you can download for pretty much every platform, and then you just turn this on, and then you can connect to it and do whatever you want, if you want to bring documents and work on them or whatever. So it's pretty useful.
That's pretty neat. Wow.
Yep, so that's, in a nutshell, you know, I'll keep sharing a lot of the Sega stuff as I go through it. Like I said, it's got tons and tons of boxes, just great stuff. And so I'm sure I'll be sharing with folks, you know, in the coming weeks and months about more and more exciting stuff. So, but that's pretty much
crazy. I still can't imagine thinking about like letting everybody out to this baby. Like I'm envisioning like this big parking lot with just tons of Sega stuff in boxes, and just like, all right, there you go, take what you want. And just I imagine like just this mad dash, and like it almost was like, you remember that old was it, was it Video Power or something? It was an old game show.
Oh, yeah.
You'd have to run through this obstacle course, and you'd have a suit on with Velcro on it, and you'd stick.
Yeah, you had to stick all this stuff. On. Yes, many things. Yeah. Yeah. No, I remember. It was sort of like that, but it was in waves and stuff, so it was kind of cool in different departments. So it was really, at least initially, people were super excited, but it was over such a long period of time that I think at the tail end, me and a couple other people who are really like the old school fans, like we're still excited, you know, and other people sort of started tapering off because they're like, I can only have so many gadgets. But we did have, which was awesome, which I made sure that one of the accounting gals had it, but a full brand new Pico set with all the games. And cool. I was like, oh, because I saw him like, oh, I should really take that just to preserve it. But I'm like, it's so big. And it takes up so much space for something I would never even open or use, and right. I think that they would actually their kids would use it because they're kind of young, so they might actually try to use it. So she got that, but there was tons of stuff like that that's like just old school things like that. Not really anything that's like games that are super valuable, but I did find just crazy stuff like a GameCube component cable, which is super rare. And stuff like
Dreamcast broadband adapters.
Dreamcast broadband adapters and weird stuff like that that people don't like. You know, like they see like, oh, I have no use for this. I'm like, oh my god, that's a Dreamcast broadband adapter, right? and just getting obscure stuff to have, because I didn't have like a gear-to-gear cable for hooking up two game mm-hmm. gears, and things that I just never had in my collection. But I'm like, oh, what is it? I'm like, oh wait, I think this is like a Game Gear to Game Gear connector, or the Game Gear like a magnifying glass, and you know, the still boxes, and just weird stuff like that. And so I grabbed like just tons of stuff like that. So who knows what I have in there, but I haven't gone through it all. But so it was good. Well, good times.
I just subscribed to your YouTube video, channel, so I'm looking forward to that. So everyone, if you guys want to see like more of all the crazy stuff that Steven was able to get his hands on, go subscribe to his YouTube channel. It's Frostman007. Search him on there, you'll be able to find him.
Thank awesome. You, yep. But, yeah, in a nutshell, that's basically what I've been sort of doing the last couple of weeks. How about you guys?
Blake, I'll let you go first, buddy, because I know you got quite a bit of games and stuff that you picked up, too. What else we got?
Well, I paid for mine. I've also been job hunting. I think the exact day that you tweeted out that it was your last day, I think that was actually my last day at my old position also. So, yeah. Oh, well, so sad for everyone. let's see. Yesterday, actually, I bought Mighty Switch Force on the Wii U. It's on sale for the 25th anniversary of Own Nuts. Now I can't remember the name of the company. What's the name of the company? Mighty Switch Force. DuckTales. Come on, come on, come on. Shoot. Well, anyway, it's on sale on Wii U. I bought it.
DuckTales, Way Forward? No.
Way Forward. Yeah, Shantae and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, Shantae. Sorry to interject, but I can't believe, you know, like, I did not know this, and I had this, and I was just, like, tossing around, but the original Shantae for the Game Boy Color mm-hmm. is quite rare and valuable,
yes,
I guess.
Yes, it is.
I was not aware, because it was, like, it just, I had never paid attention to thinking about that, and I have, like, one or two copies of that just, like, laying around, like, oh my gosh, like, I stumbled upon, like, this article said, like, the top 20 games that are rare or valuable that you don't know of, and I was like, wait a minute, Shantae? And I'm like... So, yeah, that was kind of cool.
No, that's great. I was working at Toys R Us when that game was, I wouldn't say new, because we had the Game Boy Advance at the time. And we had tons of copies of Shantae. We were eventually trying to sell it for $10. We couldn't give them away. I don't know what happened to them. I wound up leaving the store before they were sold. But yeah, it was kind of crazy that that one turned out.
That was a late release.
Yes, it was very late.
So there was probably not a lot of copies that they produced either, right?
Well, right. It was neat because they had like improved color palette if you played on your GBA. So they actually did a little bit forward thinking that if you played the game in GBA, that the color palette was increased, which is pretty good forward thinking. So you know, kudos to them for that. But,
yeah. Let's see, retro pickups. Of course, you and I went out on Friday this week and hit some stores, some disappointing stores, some less disappointing stores, retail places mostly, and I picked up a few things. I'm not going to rattle them all off, so I think I'm going to be getting nearly like 15 games. But let's see, if I remember right, let's see, I got G-Lock on Genesis, the Garfield on Genesis, Roar of the Beast, and Bimini Run. Those are all Genesis games. Also got Virtua Fighter on 32X, so yeah, added nice. That to the collection. It's actually... I remember it's better than the original Saturn version, seeing as how glitchy that original Saturn version was.
Yeah, so, it's pretty good.
So that's like my sixth or seventh 32X game. I got some NES and Super Nintendo games also. Not too many worth mentioning. I'll just mention I got Thunder Spirits on Super Nintendo, which is the same game as Thunder Force 3 on Genesis, but they changed the name when they released on Super Nintendo, so I'd like to do a comparison at some point between the two versions and see what's different, see where it plays better on what and why. Also, I guess of note, I got the original Ninja Turtle game on NES.
Oh, nice. That's good. That's great.
Which I've never owned. And my wife asked me, did you ever have this as a kid? And I don't remember if we had the game or not, but we certainly played it enough. I think it's just one of those games that everybody else in the world had, so if we wanted to borrow it, we could. And, so I played through that game, cheating, a couple nights ago on my Retron 5 because I... don't think I would have had the patience to play through the entire game without cheating. But it is a lot of fun. It is still very hard. Even when you cheat, it's not super easy. But let's see. Otherwise, I got my Smash Brothers soundtrack in the mail this week. That's what we were listening to in the car as we were driving around Friday, so I got that the day before. So pretty jazzed to see that. Of course, it doesn't have any Sonic or Mega Man tracks on it, and I suspect that's because Capcom and Sega both sell their own Sonic and Mega Man soundtracks.
Yeah,
because there are still some Pac-Man tracks on there, That's my guess, but you know, whatever. I guess I just have to buy the Sonic soundtracks if I want those. But that's pretty much my story for the week.
Cool. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. We went out to like two or three different places, and I ended up picking up an Odyssey 2 at this one spot we went to.
It was
actually a pretty good deal for it. It didn't come in boxed or anything, but it was the Odyssey 2, and it came with about almost like 10 games or so. But I came home and ended up picking it up the following night, and it didn't work.
So
it's like, yeah, it's a bummer. Like, it looks like there might be something going on with like the I don't think it's the power cable. Like,
is it a fuse or something?
It might be, and I'm not knowledgeable enough about all that stuff to really start digging into the system and trying to figure out what's going on. So I think I'm just gonna have to end up taking it back. But the guy there, he had a lot of like good stuff. He had a boxed Fairchild F system that was just in like almost like mint condition. It was in very, very, very good condition. I think I'm gonna actually go back up there after we get off the podcast and exchange, return it. I might end up picking up the Fairchild, but he also had another. It was just a regular Odyssey, but it was still boxed. It had never been played in just ultra good condition. He had a lot of just other stuff. He had a TurboGrafx-16 that he was selling for about $100, which actually is not that bad of a deal because TurboGrafx stuff has gone up in price a lot in the last few years. So that's actually not too bad. If I didn't have one, I would have bought that. He's just always got like a lot of older, like weird stuff, which is, you know, a big reason why I like going in there. You just never can tell what he has. Last time he had a box 7800 that I really wish I would have bought now, and a lot of games with it, but it's not there anymore. I was really hoping that he'd still have that so I can get that. But one other thing that I did get in this week is an SG-1000 Model 2. Which, man, I've been wanting one of these for a long time. So if people don't know what the SG-1000 is, this is the system that Sega produced in Japan before the Master System. It was never officially released in the United States. I think it was just Japan, Australia, and maybe a few other regions around there. This is the Model 2. And then they came out with the Mark III, which is... it ended up being what the Master System was when they brought it over to the United States. But here are a couple of the games that came with it. They almost look like Atari cartridges. So they're about the same size and all. So I got Champion Pro Wrestling, Champion Baseball, and Champion Boxing. Now, the games, I mean, these were released. So Champion Pro Wrestling was released in 85, so it was a bit of a later release. But some of the other ones, Baseball was released in 83, and Boxing was in the following year in 84. But especially the boxing game, I was really surprised just graphically, like what they were able to get on there. It actually is a pretty decent game. Blake, we were playing it last night, and it's really interesting because you're on the same plane. So it's essentially like a two-dimensional fighter. You know, you're not moving back and forth into around the ring like you would in a normal boxing. It's just kind of you're just going back and forth, and you can move your arms like up or down to protect like your head or your body from punches, and you cycle through like styles of punches, like uppercut or a jab or a cross or a straight, and you're basically cycling through and then and pressing the other button to do it. And it's actually a lot of fun. I don't know about you, Blake, but I actually really enjoyed boxing.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too because you got stomped.
I was like, I'm so jealous of you guys because you always seem to have these places, you have these mom and pop stores and things like that that you can drive to and find. It's like really hard. Like you think in the Bay Area, in San Francisco Bay Area, that there'd be more stuff like that, but it's really, you know, hard to find like store outlets that do that. And if they do, they sell just your standard, you know, standard arsenal of stuff, and you don't really get like the hardware that you have and things like. Which, speaking of actually classic, I forgot to show this, but I got a lot of weird stuff like this, which you don't really see, which is like, you know, still sealed packaging. Like,
oh, nice.
Whoa!
So I have a bunch of these and things like. See, this is sort of the random stuff that I have that you just don't see anymore, right? I guess I should. For the Sega Master System and stuff, and every time you guys talk about this stuff, I'm like, man, you know, because I have to resort to like eBay or like Craigslist or things like that, and there's no easy place where I could try to find a good deal on some of that old hardware. You know, it kind of sucks. I'm always jealous of you guys because of that.
Yeah, for the SG-1000, I did go to eBay for that just because it's you can't find that anywhere. I don't think I've even seen games for sale, even at any of the conventions I go to or anything like that. I just don't see anything. I finally found one that was like a decent price. Like if you go look on eBay, most of them are priced like over $200 or $300, just a ridiculous amount. And this one was priced at I think 120, and I was able to do some back and forth like counter offers to them. I got them down to about $95. And then I got to throw in a couple of the games. So that was probably the best deal I was going to get. And I would just be waiting around forever to get it if I didn't just kind of pull the trigger on it. So I went and did it. And I'm having a lot of fun with it so far. The controller, I posted a photo on our Instagram. It's really weird because it's very similar to a Master System controller, but it's white. And actually, Master System controllers are compatible with it too. Oh. So it only came with one, and I plugged in a Master System controller in it, and Blake was able to use that. But what's weird about it is the controller comes out the side where the buttons are, the cable does. And so your kind of hand has to go around it. It's weird that they wouldn't just put it up top.
Yeah.
Most other controllers do. So it's kind of strange, from that perspective. But I've not played baseball yet. And I plan on doing that later today. But I'm having a lot of fun with it. I also bought soccer. It's going to be coming in soon. So definitely check that out. If you guys are interested in learning more about the SG-1000, we actually have a really neat YouTube series on our YouTube channel called Ages of Sega. So we got one of our staff writers is going through and basically playing through all of the SG-1000 games from the very first game until the very end. So if you're interested in doing that, go check that out because there's a lot of neat games and stuff out there. So
that's awesome. How much are the games running about for that?
And that's the thing. It's really tough to get a solid idea on like what the true value is on these games because it's a lot like, and this is where I was talking to Blake about it earlier in the week. Like what the sellers are doing now, they're just listing set prices at about like $30.
Yeah.
It just depends on. And so I actually got soccer for like $1. I was able to get that really cheap. But you don't see that one or any other ones listed that low. Most of them are set prices. So you don't really know what the true value is on them. And there's some other ones that I really want to get, like Girls Garden is one I want to get. Congo Bongo is one that I'm also looking at getting. So I will keep you guys updated on my SG-1000 hunt.
That seems like an interesting podcast idea too, like just for people hunting, like for, you know, like I don't know if there's even a website. Is there a website for that? Like, you know, hunting for nostalgic systems and be able to trade with people. Like, you know, I've got a Sega Master System controller that's mint. I'm looking for, you know, blah controller. Does anyone want to trade? I mean, it seems like there could be like a potential for that somehow. I don't know.
There are Facebook groups like that.
Yeah. You look into that.
Blake's always commenting on those because every time he comments, it'll pop up to the top of my feed. And I'm like, oh, yep, there's Blake again commenting on some random Facebook group. So that would be fun to do that. And there is a pretty good a YouTube channel called The Game Chasers. I don't know if you've ever seen that, Steven. And they kind of just go out and it's almost like American Pickers. So it's that style. It's kind of just like watching them go out and trying to find expensive or, you know, like rare games at different video game stores or flea markets and things like that. It's based in Texas, but they really travel around all over the place because now they're getting more popular, so they go out to different conventions and stuff. So on the way to, like, say they go up to like Canada. So on the way to Canada, they're filming the entire time, stopping at all these little places along the way. And it's actually pretty interesting. And you can kind of pick up some pretty good, like, negotiating tactics and things like that when you're going and buying retro games from stores and things like that. So it's kind of neat from that perspective.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I feel bad because it's like, if only for these groups, and it's going to be less and less, like, of people who are protecting and keeping these old games. They're just going to, you know, like, people throwing stuff away because they don't know what it is. And it gets a little sad. You know, I get a little sad about that sometimes because I think about, like, in, like, 5 years, 10 years, you know, what's going to remain of some of these older systems, right? So
it's crazy just to think about this. I mean, the SG-1000 was released, I think, in 82, and it's just about as old as I am, and it's still working. It's just nuts that thing is still working. But, I mean, we don't know how long these things are really going to be with us and stuff, especially some of the older disc-based systems and stuff like the 3DO or the, you know, CD and stuff. And I mean, the CDs do have like a shelf life. They're not going to just last forever. And so it's going to be sad once those start kind of going away.
Yeah. Just buy them all, everybody. Keep them all.
So I guess we should probably talk a little bit of some news throughout the week. Blake, do you want to run through the news desk and start us off with that?
Yeah, sure, that's fine. Okay, the big release this week, 3D Outrun on the 3DS. If you haven't played those M2 arcade classics or the 3D classics that they put together, they're always really good. They've always got some great visual options and control options. I haven't got a chance to try Outrun yet, but Super Hang-On's fantastic, Space Harrier's fantastic. Chris, you bought Outrun?
I have. I did buy it when it came out. I've only been able to mess with it for maybe like half an hour or so, so I can't really talk a lot about some of the new additions and stuff like that I've seen. I know Jason has his review pending on the site, so that should go live on the website tomorrow. Steven, have you been playing it much?
Yeah, I mean, I played those. I mean, I've been playing those for, you know, as we go along. I used to sit next to the producer Sam Mullen, who handles the U.S. localization of all those three 3D titles. And so, you know, especially for those who are getting into those classic games and want to know more about these sort of conversions, not really even ports. They're really lovingly kind of created specifically for the 3DS. Sam does a great job translating these intricate interviews from Japan. And they get posted on the Sega blog site, which I think is blog.sega.com. I'm sure you can find it, but they're amazing reads, and you will really appreciate the hard work that goes into this. You know, a lot of people who play games, when they see a port of something, you know, especially an older game for a system, they don't think that very much goes into it. That's pretty easy because the hardware is so much more powerful. But the dev teams who are crafting these 3D titles, taking the old games and bringing them, they put so much attention to detail into it, and they have to think a lot about how the 3D works. Like, you know, in Sonic, how the trees are in the background, how Sonic can run through them, and the problem, you know, originally before of how they were handled and how they have to be handled now so that Sonic looks like he's running behind them or in front of them. And that just that is like a person's trying to figure out how to handle it. So there's an amazing amount of work that goes into these conversions, and the level of detail is amazing, and it's hard to get across in words. If you read any of these translated interviews, you'll see how much like passion and how much like just hard work these guys put into each of these titles to make it the best possible scenario, and how do they accurately sort of capture the arcade experience in different ways, especially like, you know, Afterburner and things like that, and the things that they've done for that. And also just like, you know, the intricacies of the sound systems. I think there's one where the sound system had like a certain particular way of handling stuff, and so they replicated that exactly on the 3DS, and it's amazing. So definitely please do, if you're interested at all in any of these kind of classic games, definitely check out the interviews on the Sega community sites, because you'll definitely, I think, enjoy them, and they're very good reads.
Yeah, and one of the things that I'm always like really interested in checking out when any of these new games come out is like switching it into like the arcade mode, where it looks like you're sitting inside one of these old cabinets.
Yes.
Because they do go back, like you were saying, like the attention to detail is really amazing, because they go back and as accurately as possible, you know, on a 3DS, they go back and replicate the feel, the motion, the way everything tilts in these old, you know, arcade cabinets, the ones that actually moved around, you could sit in and things like that. They recreate all that kind of stuff, and there's just so many options that you can move into. You could go into, like, whether you want, you know, the Japanese soundtrack, whether you want, you know, the American soundtrack, all this other, you know, just really neat stuff that, I mean, these really are the very, very best, like, ways to go back and experience some of these games, because they're just so well done. And like you said, they're not just ports of the old games. There's a ton of work that M2's put in to doing this. It's amazing. I love each and every one of these releases that come out.
Do you have a favorite one that you like the best? Both of you guys?
Oh man. You know, and the one I'm probably going to say, and I think Blake, I was telling you about it a couple days ago, is I think I really like Altered Beast, just because of the fact that you get to see it in such crisp graphics. The visuals look so good, and playing you know, Altered Beast on my Genesis on my crappy TV. It just, although everything looks real kind of blurry and muddy, and to be able to see it in like what you probably were able to see it like in the arcades and something like, you know, really crisp and clear. I love just being able to see that. So Altered Beast is one of my favorites.
My favorite one is still Space Harrier. I play that one the most. I like all the different control options as far as with the control pad. It centers you automatically if you use the actual digital pad. Mm-hmm. It'll keep you where you want to be. The accelerometer works. And the way it tilts the screen is amazing. And also, you mentioned some of the changes they made to make the game look like the arcade. They even changed like the sounds. So if you set the options right, you can hear the motor clicking as the screen is tilting from left to the right, so you hear these little clicks. You hear the click of the token or coin going into the slot when you insert your credit or whatever at the beginning of the game. I just love that to death. So I found myself going back to Space Harrier more than any other. So I'd say that's my favorite one.
That's pretty cool. What about you, Steven? What's one that you like the most?
I don't know. I don't know if I have a favorite one. I think I've spent so much time on each of them playing them that, and just sitting next to Sam and his excitement stuff, I just love them all. You know, I just think they're great, and I've played them sort of to death. So, I don't know. I, for some reason, the Afterburner one, I just, for that one, it seemed like there was so much effort put into that one as far as the cockpit and the different things that they did, and just how to, like, target things in 3D, you know, with the reticule and things like that. And there's all this kind of behind-the-scenes stuff to get it to work. So I really, really love that one. But Ultra Beast 2, similar for the reasons that you kind of say, it's kind of neat to see it on such a sort of crisp experience. And Ultra Beast, regardless of its issues and stuff, always is like, it's one of my classic favorite Genesis games, you know, because I remember that moment when I first saw it in a display with the Genesis. I'm like, oh my gosh, what is this game, right? It's like amazing. So that's always one that I kind of go to see the quality of like, you know, like a port or a conversion. So I definitely love that one as well.
And I think Altered Beast was the very first Genesis game that I ever saw playing. I went over to my cousin's house, I remember, and he would always get the systems like before everyone else, so he was kind of spoiled in that way. But I just remember walking into his room, and I mean, we had like a 2600 at the time, so we were kind of poor. We didn't really have the new stuff. And I just remember going in and seeing him play it, and I was like, what is this? This looks amazing! I was so blown away by it. So for you know that reason and others, Altered Beast always is going to have a special place in my heart. And I still think it has one of the best box arts of all time. I absolutely
love
that. So.
No, totally.
I'll speak for Graham real quick. I'm sure he would say that Galaxy Force is going to be his favorite one.
That is a great game. I mean, that is a solid, just amazing. That was one of the early ones that I was just like, wow, it's like looks so good, I think, that they did a bang-up job on that one.
Yeah, I've played that one quite a bit as well. It's a tough call between that and Space Harrier, but I do know I spend more time playing the Space Harrier. I should note real quick, I know internationally, at least in the UK, maybe some other markets, several of the first wave of these games are on sale. I think it's the whole first wave absent Sonic. So there'd be Echo, Shinobi 3, Streets of Rage, Ultra Beast, Galaxy Force 2, Space Harrier, Super Hang-On. They're on some kind of sale, so if you're an international listener, go check those out. I don't know if there's a U.S. sale coming or anything like that. Again, it does not include Sonic, and it does not include any of the second wave that started with Afterburner 2. So no Afterburner, no Fantasy Zone, and no Outrun, which just released this week. But those are $5.99, which is still a really good deal for the amount of attention to detail that was put into those.
Yeah,
and I say to everyone, like, this is a classic case, right, where if you're liking what Sega is doing, you know, support them, buy more, and that's what, you know, Sam's always fighting the hard fight to bring more of this stuff, right? The localization guys are like, they want to bring more of this stuff over, so, but they need ammunition, and they need, you know, proof that it's going to succeed, and it's going to do well, so definitely, if you guys are on the fence, those of you watching or listening, go out and buy those 3D classics so that more and more can come and the teams can work on more of them. You know, show your support so that they can start releasing more of that stuff.
Yeah, and I think the guys at SegaBits, they tweeted something that, like, I think it was, as far as the 3DS charts go, it was like 13 or 14 or something like that. It was selling, 3D Outrun seemed to be selling fairly well on the 3DS eShop, so that's good news.
Yeah.
That's been a fan favorite. I think people are really excited to see that one was coming, so hopefully the sales are reflecting that. All right, moving on to next story, I suppose. Let's see. Toe Jam and Earl, the Kickstarter this week added console versions as stretch goals. So right now you can expect a PlayStation 4 version of the game if they reach the $600,000 stretch goal, an Xbox One version of the game at $700,000, and the mythical Wii U version of the game at $800,000. right now, I just checked a few minutes ago, and the Kickstarter has, what, like 12 days left, maybe 14 days left?
I think it's 12.
12 days left, and they're sitting at about $288,000. So the last few days are always a big push for lots of Kickstarters. Hopefully they'll be able to close that gap. I certainly seem to be able to get to that 400, depending on how well they close that gap. Getting to those stretch goals, though, 600, 700, and again, especially that 800,000 for the Wii U one, that seems like, well, I guess it seems like a bit of a stretch at the moment. But the PlayStation 4, I wouldn't say that's unrealistic, but if you're sitting on the fence thinking, well, I really only want to play this on a console like I was, because I don't care to play it on a PC, then there's an opportunity to commit something to it and hopefully help them close that gap and get to one of those console ports. Let's see. That's really about all I have to say about that.
One of the things I was going around, I think I saw there was a NeoGAF thread about the Kickstarter, and I've seen, you know, this kind of mentality going around, you know, in other places on Twitter and other things. So people were basically posting and saying something like, well, if it gets funded, or if it meets its funding goal, I'll you know, contribute some money toward it. And I think that's a really weird way to kind of go about, you know, a Kickstarter that you're interested in, because, you know, you need to, if you're interested in contributing to Toe Jam and Earl, you should absolutely go and pledge some money to it now to ensure that the game is going to get funded. Because if it doesn't get funded, you know, it's not going to happen, and then you're not going to be able to play it ever. And instead of just waiting to put any money toward it, until it gets funded, I think that's kind of a backwards way to go about it. So if you're interested in it, definitely consider going ahead and pledging some money to it, because, you know, Greg Johnson, he's such a good guy. He's one of the nicest guys you could ever meet in the video game industry, and you know, I know that he has a huge passion for Toe Jam and Earl, and I think this game's going to be really good from everything I've seen of it. And everything else, I'm a huge fan, and I think he's going to do pretty well with this. Steven, have you kept up with this Toe Jam and Earl Kickstarter project at all?
Yeah, I was reading about it a little bit. I'm glad that it's, you know, we've had sort of a history of those kind of Sega games coming, you know, the Echo situation, things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's good, and Booger Man and all these other classic kind of games, James Pond and things like that. So it's always good when one is actually sticky and it looks like it has a chance of, you know, actually going all the way and stuff like that. So I'm excited about that. I'm a fan of Toe Jam and Earl. I'm not a huge fan of Toe Jam and Earl. It's one of those. It's because I didn't really play it as hardcore as I did when it came out. I played it later in life, like years later. So I didn't have that initial just interest in it. But having played it years later, I do enjoy and stuff like that. I'm just not like the uber fan that some of you guys are for sure of it. But I was thinking, like, you know, I was reading up on some of these fundraiser stuff, and it's kind of interesting. Like, you know, like Indiegogo, they have that thing where if you're on Indiegogo, you can you can say that even if it's not funded, the money still goes to the group, and they'll try to do their best to come out with it in some form or another. Versus the Kickstarter way, where if you don't hit the goal, even if you're like, you know, $100 short of your goal, right, no one gets the money. It's kind of interesting. I wonder how that's going to boil out as far as options. Because I think Kickstarter, I think there has been a lot of projects that have gotten relatively close, you know, and that the team could have come up with a product that's maybe like smaller in scope and still come out versus completely canceling it. So, I mean, what are you guys' thoughts on that? I mean, would you be okay with, say, Toe Jam and Earl coming, and they said this is the scale of the project. They don't quite make their goal, but despite that, they still get the money, and they come out with a smaller scale game versus like just saying, oh, well, we got to figure out what we're doing. We'll maybe come back in the future. Like, what are you guys' thoughts on that?
Yeah, if I think that's the options that we have, I would absolutely be, you know, okay with something like that, because even if it's not something that's going to be as feature rich and have a lot of the, you know, the bells and whistles and options, just having a new entry in the series, I know for me personally, I'm a big fan, so I would absolutely be interested in something like that. I think that would be a neat thing if they had that ability to do that. I know Indiegogo, I think if you there's the two options that you can have, I think, when you have an Indiegogo campaign. It's one, you can either have it, like, you either make the money or you don't get anything like Kickstarter does, or you can have the one that you did, and I think they take a larger percentage of the money if you do it that way. Mm-hmm. I think that's how it goes. But what about you, Blake? What would you be into something like that?
I think 9 times out of 10, I'd rather see the game be made, like you said, with maybe less features, shorter, smaller scale, than have it just go away forever. That's one of the things that makes me sad, see that, yeah, they don't get anything. Again, maybe there's some situation where I'd only want to see the game this way, but, yeah, I think 9 times out of 10, I'd rather see it kind of fruition one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And actually, one that I was following, and which was I thought was kind of sad, but I guess it just no one's interested anymore, was Seventh Guest. It was a second sequel to Seventh Guest, and it had started, I think, on Indiegogo or Kickstarter. I can't remember if it started on Kickstarter for a full game, and it was kind of high, and there just wasn't interest. I don't think a lot of people has much like love for Seventh Guest as like that was one of the heart of the early days of the CD-ROM medium, right? Mm-hmm. Myst and Seventh Guest and stuff. And so I love those games, even though they're very basic. And so I think they tried to fund it on Kickstarter, and then it didn't make it. And then they went to Indiegogo, I think, and for a partial pay, it still didn't make it. And so I said, okay, and then we'll try to do a demo. So we'll do this in phases. So we'll do a demo that you're funding or like the first part of the game, and that still didn't make it. And I was like, so sad. I'm like 3 times, like it kind of bombed. But yeah, but anyway, that's
it's really tough though too. I mean, as a developer, like you have to come go by and like, okay, so why didn't this game, you know, get funded? Is it the fact that there's just not an audience for it anymore, or is it that there's so many things that go into like what makes a successful Kickstarter campaign? Like you said, a lot of times people, you know, they feel like they need a demo out there to, you know, get people over any sort of, you know, maybe hesitancy that they might have to go and you know, pledging some money toward it. I know for me personally, I am such a big like retro gamer, and I love all these retro games that I, for the most part, any of these old ones that come that are brought back by some of these old you know, companies, I will go ahead and pledge to. I remember I don't know if you saw the I think it was a Night Trap. They were looking to bring like a remastered Night Trap out and like last year, and that one didn't make it either. It's really tough.
Wasn't there like a lot of just like weirdness going on around that, right? I remember that, and like I was reading because I was trying to piece it together, because there are some people who are saying like, oh, there's some sort of scam going on, and some of the stuff. And I think you talked to them too, did you not? About like how they were handling the video, and then it turned out that they were going to like make new video or something like that. What was the situation with that?
I'm trying to remember about it now. I know a lot of people were saying that they felt that they were asking for too much money for what it was, because essentially what they were going to be doing is going back and just kind of remastering some of the video.
Yeah.
They thought that, you know, they didn't need that much money, and so there was a lot of that going on. I'm trying to go back and actually see if I can remember some of it. So yeah, there was a lot of kind of weirdness that was going on with that, and so it just kind of went away, and we didn't really hear from it again after that. So it was back in September. If you want to look at it, you know, those listening, we have several stories of it. We covered that whole thing quite a bit on the site, but it is tough. I mean, and it seems like a lot of these retro, games that come out for Kickstarter, they either, you know, do really, really well or just, like, do really bad. And so I'm hoping that Toe General will end up getting successfully funded, because I definitely want to see that. It doesn't look like we'll probably get a Wii U version of it at the $800,000 tier, but even if it's just PC, I'm actually okay, you know, with that. I'm down with that, so we'll see.
Yeah, it's tough. Like, I applaud those people who are going on Kickstarter, but it's certainly so many variables and the timing of it. There's so many unknowns, right? Like, it could be just a timing thing, and something else is stealing the spotlight on Kickstarter, and so you're not getting the attention that you need. And I can only imagine how nerve-wracking it must be, and like deciding on how much money you need, and trying to create a presentation on the website that actually convinces people that you can actually do it. So, I mean, I give props to anyone who is on that site and trying to make something, you know.
Yeah, it's crazy. So,
well, I'm going to skip ahead a story here because we're on the topic of games that are never coming to Wii U. And so I'm going to talk about Tembo the Badass Elephant was announced this week. It's announced for PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and Steam. And so this is, oh goodness, a game being published by Sega, being developed by the Pokemon people, whose name I can't
remember.
Game Freak. Yes, thank you. So I guess that's why one expected there should be a Wii U version of this game. There's actually a lot of, I guess, controversy that followed on. I was like, oh my gosh, it's a 2D side-scroller. Why isn't there a Wii U version of this game? I would calmly say to everyone, because it doesn't tap into any Nintendo nostalgia, therefore no one will buy it. But anyway, the game looks great. The videos that came out, it looks smooth, very interesting character design for a side-scroller, giant elephant that seems to slam through everything. It looks like it's a lot of fun. It may convince me at some point to pick up an Xbox One or a PlayStation 4, because I'm not likely to play it on Steam. Anyway, but what are your thoughts on this?
Steven, have you seen this? I'm sure you're well aware of it.
Yeah, I actually, you know, like, it was one of those ones that I wasn't aware of until it got leaked. I wasn't even, maybe it was going on and people were talking about it at the Sega offices, but I certainly was oblivious to that one. So that kind of came as a bit of a surprise to me. Yeah, it seems interesting, certainly, but, you know, we'll see how it goes. I'm interested in playing it because I like some of that quirky stuff, and I'm not quite sure if it's just quirky for the sake of being quirky. Like, what can we do to get people's attention? We're going to make an elephant that, you know, it's like the Hulk.
he's badass.
He's badass, and he's badass because he says that he's badass, you know, and it's kind of like the lesson that I always said, you know, working on Sonic or any other characters at Sega, and I'm like, the moment that you have to tell someone that a character is cool, they're uncool. You know?
Awesome kickstarts on Machino's butt.
Yeah, and it's like, and there's a tons of those back in the day, especially in the mascot wars when you had Arrow the Acrobat and everyone who was competing against Sonic, and we're cool because we're telling you that he's cool, and you can't tell people that, especially these days. You have to let them discover that on their own and make their own judgment about it, and I think that when you tell people that something is cool to them, instantly they don't want it to be cool, you know. So that's a tough thing. But regardless, it looks like an interesting game. I love that sort of arcadey kind of smashing and destroying stuff up. Reminds me a little bit of the Hulk DS game we worked on with WayForward back in the day for Incredible Hulk, where you're going around and smashing stuff up, which was, I thought, a bit of a fun. I know I'm interested. I'm not like blown away by it, but definitely intrigued, and will definitely check it out.
Yeah, I really like just how colorful it is. I mean, there's just so much colors going on screen, and I like the art direction of it. I think it looks like a fun game, and that's what I was talking to some people on Twitter and stuff, and they were just kind of saying that it looks like, to them, it kind of almost what you're saying, Steven, that it's just, it looks like Hell Yeah, which is kind of like basically kind of almost like a forced like coolness and attitude and things like that, and I could certainly see that. But I think especially with, you know, 2D platformers like this, it's all in the gameplay, and so you really can't tell how good this game's going to be until you really get down and really play it and see kind of like, you know, just the physics and everything and. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, it's supposedly pretty far in development. I think at EGX Res, they're going to have a playable demo of it, which I think, I don't know if EGX Res is this weekend or is still upcoming. But yeah, for those in England, if you're going to be going to that, definitely go and try Tembo because it's going to be there. I wish I was over there so I could play it. But it looks pretty funny to me. I'm interested in it. I'm glad it's not a mobile game because even when I first saw the trailer, I was like, "Oh man, is this going to be mobile?" And then I saw the PlayStation logos and Xbox. I was like, "Okay, sweet, this is going to be a console game. I think it's going to be a lot more fun." So, looking forward to that. A summer release date on for Tembo. So
only single player, right? I didn't read it. It was only a single player experience. I wonder if there's a.
I don't know if they came out and said only single player, but I guess I assumed just looking at it that it would be. But that would be a kind of a neat thing to see if they had some sort of co-op or just a two-player game that you could just take turns playing through levels. It'll be interesting. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'll be his twin albino elephant. You know,
that's what I was saying. It would be one of those, if you really want to kind of keep the old school style, it would just be another elephant that's just like a different like palette swap for a color or something. It would be funny.
Don't have to do any new animations.
Well, maybe we'll eventually get a Wii U version of the game, you know, 4 years from now, and the second player will just tap annoyingly on the screen, on the gamepad screen, and like create mice or something to scare your elephant, and that'll be the second player experience. So.
Wow, Wii U 4 years from now, you're ambitious there as far as...
well, yeah.
He is a pretty hardcore Wii owner, so...
Who was it?
That's exactly why.
Seriously. Everyone was that was hardcore. That was the de facto hardcore system.
Yep.
Right. Moving on to our last news item. Sega announced Hyper Dimension Neptunia versus Sega Hard Girls is going to be a new title for the PS Vita, and it's being developed by Compile Heart. So I don't think that much is known about the game specifically. Hyper Dimension Neptunia has been a series developed by Compile Heart for several years now. It pretty much re-envisions the console wars as some sort of bizarre anime world where different characters represent different consoles. I've never played it. It always seemed really interesting to me, but it's always been a PlayStation exclusive thing, so I've kind of missed out on it. And of course, Sega Hard Girls is the anime that Sega put out over the last year or so, where they have different female characters representing old Sega consoles specifically. So it makes sense. It seems like it could be interesting. Looking forward to it. Let's see. I don't think there's really all that much else that we have right now.
Yeah, there's not a lot of information on it right now, at least as far as we know. There might be some others floating around out there. But it's something that one of the first Hyper Dimension Neptunia games, the one that they actually released it on Steam not too long ago. I think it was Rebirth. I think it was the first one. So I played around with it a little bit. I'm kind of familiar with it, not too far into it, but I'm interested in getting a Sega Hard Girls video game because I was a big fan of the anime. I really liked that. It was just so kind of tongue-in-cheek, and it really reminded me of that kind of the old-school Sega, you know, how it just – they were very – like a lot of – some of the games were kind of self-aware almost, and it just had a really fun humor about it. This is that same style. I really enjoyed it. And it's going to be interesting to see what they do with this video game, if it's going to be like a straight-up fighting game or what it's going to be. I'm really looking forward to it. And I can see this completely being a game either that I import or end up downloading digitally. I'm absolutely going to have to play this game. So,
well, what I hear is that it's a breakdance battle game. I'm sure like Kotb's head like exploded when he saw this. I was so it's like he probably like is dead now. Have you checked on him? He might be just completely dead.
I tell you what, I had about 30 Facebook messages from him in the middle of the night, and he was like, "OMG!" It was funny. You could tell he couldn't even have waited for us because he actually ended up writing the article himself, which is pretty funny. But yeah, Kopke, this is like his ultimate game. Like if there's one game that they could create, this would be Kopke's ultimate video game. So it's going to be awesome. I'm sure Sam, your buddy Sam's probably pretty excited for it as well, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I expect so. And you know, it's funny, like... I really like because we used to watch the Sega Hard Girls cartoon at Sega. So every week people were interested, and we'd have like a period where the day stopped, and then we'd load up Crunchyroll and we'd watch it in the big TV and just chill out for like 11 minutes or whatever, or 15 minutes, and had some fun. So it's great. It's kind of interesting just to see people are into it, and it really is a love letter to kind of that old school Sega. And so I think if you don't know a lot of those games, you miss a lot of the in jokes, and you miss a lot of the things in the background that we're just kind of pointing out and laughing. You know, like a couple of us are just like laughing all the time, and people are like, "What are you laughing at?" Like, I was like, "No, you don't get it. You understand that this is from this game, and he's doing. Oh, never mind." You know, and it's like, but for those who have played those games, there's so much stuff going on that's hilarious, you know, and I just kind of crack up, like, remembering some of the scenes, and especially the Virtua Fighter one, which I love the Virtua Fighter episode. It's just so silly.
That was crazy.
Those great cartoons. So if those, for those of you who haven't seen the Sega Hard Girls, like, check it out on Crunchyroll, if you remember there. It's short, it's a short cartoon, just, you can actually slip pause it so you can read the little inserts with the information between that go by. I don't know what they expect you to do for those. they're on screen for like 2.5 seconds, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't know what they, like, how they expect you to read that quickly. But definitely check it out, everyone, if you're a fan of Sega and you haven't watched it. Like I said, or do a trial. I think Crunchyroll generally has a free trial. Mm-hmm. Check out the cartoon because it's pretty fun. And like I said, it harkens back to those old days of Sega for sure.
I really like how each episode, like whenever they go into a new game, that everything takes place, like all the, like visually, everything is back into that. Like when they went to Virtua Fighter, Everything, the whole world and everything looked like Virtua Fighter or, Phantasy Star Online. Yep. It recreates everything so well. Like, it doesn't look like it's just like an anime cartoon drawn to look like that stuff. It really looks like all the, it's almost like running an engine in Phantasy Star or something like that. It's just so well done and so put together so well. And like you said, just the comedy is really well done. I wouldn't even be surprised if the whole, like, the little notes and stuff like that, if that was fully intentional just to keep it up there for like 2 seconds, just almost like how some old video game used to do something like that when stuff would scroll by way too fast. You'd be like, wait, I'm not done reading. So, I don't know. It's great. So.
Yeah, no, good stuff. Definitely check it out. And I can only imagine the approval process for that cartoon because, just working on Sonic Boom and just dealing with Sonic Team, and that's one singular sort of entity for approvals. And having to deal each week with like different groups at Sega and other outlets, and that's got to be like, that's crazy. So, I mean, kudos to them for being able to do that. It must be an insurmountable task. So.
Yeah, that is, I couldn't imagine. You know what, though? That's something that I was actually thinking about the other day because, you get, anytime, like, Sega comes out and they have some sort of report that they've either, it's just been a bad financial year or, like here recently they had to do some rounds of layoffs and stuff like that. They always go back and you start seeing all these, like, stories pop up. Like, oh, who's going to buy Sega? Is Nintendo going to come buy Sega or is it going to be Microsoft or things like that? But I was going back and thinking, how beneficial would it really be for a company to come in and try to acquire Sega? Because, like you were saying, Steven, there's a lot of like people within the company that own, certain parts of franchises and things like that. So I don't think someone coming in and just acquiring like Sega would be able to just come in and own all this stuff outright because all these original creators back in the day still retain rights, whether it's like music or IPs or games and things like that. So it would be, I think it would be very, very like technical and really hard to go and just buy everything, and then come and just, okay, we're going to run this company now how we want to, but it wouldn't be that way, I don't think, would it?
No, it's kind of messy, and this is the way back in the old days for most companies. Mm-hmm. I mean, not just Sega, but like, back in the days, in the early days, like people didn't expect that they were going to do ports of stuff or things like that, or reuse assets from a game. So a lot of the times what you see, and this has been across many of the game companies that I've worked on who have been around for a long time, that every time they kind of go back to the table and want to re-release something that's old, they've got to get either the legal permission of someone, whether it's music or something else, and also they have to kind of, from a Japanese perspective, get like the, it may not be legal right, but kind of like the honorable right to be able to do something, right? So there, part of it is certainly cultural customs, and the other part of it is just that companies didn't think far enough ahead and only did limited rights for stuff or just one-time rights so that they're always constantly having to negotiate with these people every time they do something. And it's just people didn't think that way. Now, right, it's perpetuity. Like anytime someone does something, we want the rights to the end of time. They're thinking about that stuff because they know that they're going to eventually release it on other systems or an HD version or things like that. But back then, no one thought like that. So, yeah, I mean, in any case, any of these old companies that have been around for multiple decades and stuff, someone coming in would have to negotiate for a lot of different groups from a cultural perspective and also just finding out who owns the rights. Like when I was working on Genesis Collection, the first game that I worked on at Sega when I got there, just compiling a list of the games and which groups have rights to the music, you know, like who other additional permissions we have to get to, and that sort of helps to direct your decision process, right? About, oh, this game, there's no way there's like four or five groups involved. You know, is it, what are the chances of us actually being able to do this, right? Versus something else where we own all the rights or only two people own the rights. So,
Which collection was that one? Was that Sonic's Ultimate Genesis collection?
The first one. The very first one we did, which was for the PSP and the PS2.
Okay. So
it was just basically Sega Genesis collection and Mega Drive collection, Sega Mega Drive collection.
Was that the one that had all the Phantasy Stars except Phantasy Star 1?
Yeah, I can't remember if it had Phantasy Star, but yeah, it was something like that. And it had like 30 or so games. It had like interviews and like little factoids.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and it was great. It was awesome to be exciting, especially coming into Sega for the first time and be able to work on a lot of these old classic games and trying to make sure that they're as accurate as possible. And just trying to, on the PSP, trying to get the Wi-Fi, sort of the wireless working on some of those old games.
Oh, yeah.
Because none of them were really designed for that, right? We had to spend a lot of time on a lot of those games making sure that they felt right for two players on PSP. So, but it was great. But anyway, going back to the thing, it's like, yeah, it's just dealing with all these different groups is challenging. So anyone coming in and acquiring this stuff, there's going to be a lot of legwork to make sure that you own the rights to stuff. And I would expect that, like, if a big company comes in, let's say arbitrarily Disney or Nintendo comes in and buys Sega, that the people who own those rights are not going to negotiate very easily. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, oh, yeah. Absolutely. Going back to kind of what you were saying about the Sega Genesis collection, it got me thinking because I was kind of wondering about this a while back. Do you think those old collections are going to be a thing of the past, not just at Sega, but industry-wide because of the now popularity of like the digital platforms, whether it be on the PlayStation or on the Xbox? I mean, it's so much easier for, say, you know, Sega or, you know, Capcom or someone just to go out and release you know, Toe Jam and Earl 1, you know, remastered or something like that, rather than combine all these games and put it on disc and release it that way. Do you think those are kind of just something that we won't see anymore, or do you think they may still have a life somewhere?
I think you'll still have a bit of a life there, but it's and mainly the reason that that first Genesis collection, I think it still sells occasionally. Like we release in the like a double pack and stuff, but it sells those sell well, and the six sequels to that sell so well because there's the amount of content for the amount of money is so much. So like, you know, a parent comes in, they see like, oh my God, it's like 40 games or 30 games, mm-hmm. and it costs $20. There's an intrinsic worth value, right, to have. And so I think you'll still see those, but in more limited stuff. And I think you're going to have it make it a big sell. Like it's going to have like 50 games on it or something like that. Because as the generations go by further and further, people have a hard time going back visually, right? It's one of those things where a kid will look. I mean, even now, a kid will look at, you know, like a PS1 game or even an Xbox, original Xbox game, and just kind of look at it and like, oh my gosh, this looks so bad. I don't want to play this. And I think that's just going to get worse as time and time goes on to a point where they'll just see something visual and they won't even be interested in it. You know, they won't care how good a value it is. So I think we still have a window that is feasible. Like I imagine if a big collection ever got released on like PS4 and Xbox One and Wii U together, that it would still do really well. But I think later down the road, that's kind of going to be a diminishing returns because at the cost that you'd have to put it out there, it just wouldn't be worth it to do it as a pack versus individually and just let people select it a la carte.
And I think one of the things, were you going to say something, Blake? I'm sorry.
No, I'm good. Go ahead.
Okay. No, I was just going to say one of the big things that I would imagine from these companies is like the perception of value when it comes to these old digital games. So, you know, they're always battling the mobile gaming mm-hmm. side of things and just that whole, you know, do we price, you know, this one, you know, game at $15, release it digitally versus, you know, there's other games that are almost of equal, you know, perception of these games, how good they are and everything, released for like $1 on mobile platforms and things like that. But also, you got to look at it too. You release, say, you know, Sonic the Hedgehog on, you know, the PlayStation Network at, you know, $10 or $5. But then you also put him into a collection that you can get 49 other games at $20. What is that going to do, you know, going forward to the perception of value of the Sonic the Hedgehog game? You know, like if people are going to say, why would I go and buy this new Sonic the Hedgehog game for, you know, $5 when I can go and buy the collection, I get that and, you know, all these other games for, you know, half of that or, you know, like a quarter of that price. So it's just interesting from that perspective. I kind of think of it that way. You know, like what are these companies thinking? Is this how is this going to impact the perception of value on these older games? Because I know they're very protective of that. You know, they don't want to just slash all their old games to 99 cents. Of course, they'll sell a ton of them, but what's it going to do, you know, further down the line? Because then you're, you know, leading people to believe that these games aren't worth $5 anymore. They're worth 99 cents. You know what I mean? If that makes any sense.
No, that totally makes sense. And that's a tough one. I mean, that's something you struggle as a publisher constantly. Like you think of something like, let's say, Sonic Episode 1, right? Sonic 4 Episode 1 or something. And you think, okay, it's being released on multiple platforms over the course of a certain amount of time. You can't charge, let's say you charge like $15 on a console, you can't charge $15 on mobile, right? Or, and so you can imagine, and I'm sure every publisher or company goes through this, like, we're releasing this on 8 platforms, how do we separate it enough and price it so that, you know, we don't have a situation where this, basically the same game is $15 on one platform and $5 on another platform. And, it's this big juggling match, right? And, I think that will sort of continue and parity. But I think eventually, and we're getting better at that. You know, I look at sort of the iTunes store and the Steam store as far as sales and fluctuations in price and how a developer can or a publisher can just adjust stuff on the fly and say, like, this weekend, you know, Sonic is 99 cents, right, for 2 days. And in the previous generation, there wasn't that much flexibility on the consoles to be able to adjust prices on the fly, and now we're starting to see that. So I expect that eventually what's going to help is that consoles, prices of console games, sales will end up, just because of competitive landscape, will end up fluctuating like the iTunes store and the Steam store, and you're going to have these big, you can see glimpses of that now on PS4, right? They'll do like a flash sale or something like that or things like that, and you see that more often. That wasn't something that you saw that often years ago. So I think that's going to happen quite a bit moving forward and give some of these kind of classic games an opportunity at cheaper prices for people to get interested, hopefully. Because the back catalog of games is still a huge revenue driver for publishers in general. You know, I'm sure for Namco Bandai and Capcom and everyone else. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and I, as much as I love the work that M2's been doing with the 3D classics line of games, and I love being able to support all that. I would still be okay with just Sega opening up a ton of their back catalog to be able to go and purchase and not really have all the bells and whistles that come to it. You know, sometimes I don't want to go out and, you know, pull out my Sega CD or my 32X and all the cables that come along with it. Sometimes I would just love to be able to fire up my PS4 and go back and play like Night Trap or something like that. Just some of these old games that would be great to be able to, you know, have available on some of these newer platforms, and they would make it easier on the publisher and the developers not having to go back and really rework a ton of the stuff in it to get it done and devote the time and money. So we'll see what happens.
I honestly think that the streaming stuff, like what Sony's doing and things, that the streaming of the games, especially for those older school games where the lag is not really as much of an issue because the size is so small, like that's sort of the future where basically like the main companies, first party like Sony or Microsoft or Nintendo, they're going to have streaming services, and every time someone plays a game on the streaming service, a little bit of money goes from Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo to Sega or whoever, and I think that's how the old games are going to survive. It'll just be part of a larger rental service or a larger pay, you know, like a Netflix of games sort of thing. And I think that's where we're going. A lot of the more complex games, like trying to play a PS3 game or a PS4 game, streaming is still a bit tough because of the bandwidth stuff. But there's no reason why you can't play some of these, old school games without the lag. And I think that's what you'll see. I think that's where it's going to go.
I would love that because I think. Is it PlayStation Now, right? That's their which they got from Gaikai when they bought them. I unfortunately my internet is terrible here. I think I get like 2.5 megabytes per second download.
Oh, wow.
So it's not even fast enough. I'm on old school DSL out here. I'm kind of living out in the country in Maryland. So yeah. I don't have good internet, but hopefully when I move here in a few months, I'll be able to get some faster internet and really play that. I was a big proponent of OnLive when that was more popular few years ago, and played that quite a bit. And I was just really impressed with the technology. There was some noticeable lag on some of the the more technical games, some of the newer stuff. But I think, like you said, for some of the older stuff, I don't think it would be too hard to go back and play some of those games, and I don't think the lag would be that much of an issue. So
yeah, I think that'd be great. Yeah, and I think so many people are doing that. That's where it's going to go. Like even Ouya, I was just because there's a trial. There's an app on Ouya that lets you stream games, and I was playing Arkham Asylum just to see how it is. And it played fine. Like, I was playing it. I'm just like, oh, wow, this is relatively close to what it was on the system. And, like, and if you can do that on an Ouya box, right, you can do it on anything else. And it just has to do with how good the platform is, the console is, of uncompressing that video, right, how quickly and how I can do it. Because all it is, I mean, it's sending the video signal, but it's just sending input commands, right, which is it's mostly the bandwidth is the video signal, which is why, like, on the PlayStation TV, you can adjust the quality of the video, you know, because I used to all the time at lunch, like, stream or play Destiny at my work on my PlayStation TV.
That's so cool.
Connected to my PS4 at home, and yes, there's a bit of a lag because it's a pretty intricate game, but it was certainly playable. I could do bounties and stuff like that. So I can only imagine, like, as this continues to evolve and everyone is focusing on this, that you're going to have huge, and even, you know, Steam obviously is doing this for streaming stuff. Like, I think that is going to be the future, and you're going to have, like, that's how you do backwards compatibility. You're going to see all these old games come online, and there's going to be competitors, and which platform is going to be the dominant one, and it's going to have a huge library of streamable games, and that's where you're going to get your old nostalgia from.
Wow. That's crazy. Man. Yeah. Just blew my mind a little bit there. So I want to talk to you just a little bit about your time at Sega. I know you've alluded to it a couple times now, and a lot of people probably listening are aware of the rounds of layoffs that hit Sega, not only Sega of America, but, you know, also other areas of the company. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Take us back to maybe the time when you guys first found out about it. Was this something that you guys kind of expected? Did you see anything on the horizon or anything like that? And can you talk about some of the reactions, you know, between, you know, you and your friends and those folks out there at Sega?
Sure. I mean, you know, we've had, Sega's had a few years of various layoffs. I mean, that's comes at no surprise, and it's always been hard each time, some greater layoffs than others. And, you know, I unfortunately, a lot of good friends and coworkers, close friends, you know, were let go over the past years and things like that. But, you know, that's happened to pretty much everyone. It's a changing of the industry, right, as the mobile stuff kicked in. People were trying to figure out what they need to do. You know, it moved on to that only, like, big AAA titles were selling, and the transition to mobile was happening quickly. But yet, you know, the mobile space was uncertain because people would just go from one title to another title to another title. You couldn't have – the thing about consoles that helps it is that there's an install base, and it's a dedicated install base, right? And they aren't jumping around that much, whereas in mobile, the people will jump from one game to the next hot game, and it's hard to retain them. So I think people were learning about that stuff, and during that transitional period, you know, every publisher suffered from games not doing as well as they had hoped, like the mid-tier games, right, not performing as well as they hoped. The AAA stuff always does pretty well because people look forward to those sort of events, but mid-range for sure. So, you know, and Sega has been going through a large transition because of that, and, you know, trying to figure out how to be a leaner company, as everyone does. And so, you know, we kind of did the trimming of the fat, as people always do, and, you know, it's been a multi-year process. And I think most people know that late last year, there was an announcement of another sort of reorganization of Sega Sammy. And, that was the time where we kind of knew, okay, well, there's probably going to be just speaking as a general thing, it's just expecting another round of layoffs or changes to the company. And but we didn't know to what scale or whatever. You know, based off of past experience, I just personally assumed that, oh, there's going to be just some more basic layoffs. And but, you know, in my head, I'm thinking like, well, where is this? Where are these layoffs going to come from? Because the company is pretty lean. At least Sega of America was pretty lean. Like, you know, everyone was doing multiple things. There wasn't much extraneous staffage, right? We had what we needed in order to run a company. So you start thinking like, well, maybe it's from other divisions in Sega of Japan or Sega of Europe. Because Sega Europe used to be considerably large just because they had a larger territory. And then Sega Japan, of course, being the headquarters, is quite big. And they have the arcade division and licensing division and all these other groups that a lot of us aren't even aware of as far as how big they are. So we're like, well, maybe we'll have some reorg, but it'll just be in overseas. So we weren't really, really sure. And there was no sort of information publicly or internally that we kind of knew that alluded to like how big of a change it was going to be. So we kind of went through our daily stuff. I mean, you know, that was the tail end of Sonic Boom, and I was just running around everywhere with my head cut off. And other people, it's the holiday season, so people are focused on finishing their projects as well. So they're not thinking about it too much, knowing that, okay, well, we'll have to worry about this probably the fiscal year because that's generally when this stuff happens. Yeah. And so, yeah, every once in a while we talk about it. You hear some rumblings, but nothing really concrete as to what the scale was. And since we hadn't heard anything, we just kind of seemed, oh, it's probably going to be a few layoffs here and there, but nothing really extreme. And most of the cost savings will be from reorganization of departments or, tasking people with multiple things, et cetera, et cetera. As we got closer to that time period, we kind of sensed, I think friends and I kind of sensed, oh, something's sort of going on. But again, it's happened in the past, and it could be just some bad news about whatever. It could be anything. It could be that, it sucks because we've been talking about moving locations for a while. And just because we were smaller and it made sense to move to another area. Where we're at, if for those who don't know, the location of Sega is kind of a weird area because the only stuff that's around it are like high-end like housing furniture and stuff that like contractors would go to and art galleries. So it's kind of like this kind of yuppie sort of area. And there's Zynga that's in our former building and a couple of groups like Twitter's near there. But overall, that area is really inconclusive as far as kind of a weird area for Sega to be. So it made sense. Mm-hmm. We understood that we could move. So we thought, oh, okay, well, finally, maybe we're going to move and people are kind of just uneasy about having to pack up and move everything. And because previously we had moved, we used to have two floors at the our current Sega building and we all moved to one floor because it's pretty big space. And so we're like, oh, we got to move again. This is going to be annoying. And they don't want to share that news with us that we're moving. But I was excited. I'm like, oh, we're going to move. I always like, you know, new location, new opportunities and things like that. I can't really sort of talk about internal messaging, but as far as the when we were really discussing with friends was the night we were playing Destiny, and the night before the announcement sort of went out, and we saw a press release from Japan. That one that I think everyone reported on, I think TSSC reported on, stuff like that. And that was really that the reality kicked in then. Like, because we had sort of thought about it and what could happen. What we had some little rumblings maybe and things like that. But as with every corporation, they have to hold things close to their chest. And so we read that announcement. And we were playing. I remember playing on Destiny, and one of my coworkers was like, "Steve, you got to read this press release from Japan." I'm like, "Oh, it's probably the bad news, right? Is it announcing like what's going on?" And I was thinking in my head like, "Oh, it's going to be layoffs. Maybe some of us are going to lose our jobs. It's going to suck like normally." But then I saw the relocation to Southern California, and I'm like, "Oh, that's not good." That's not good, because while we had thought about like I said, layoffs, the whole move thing was the big shocking thing. And then from the move aspect that was announced in the press release, you start putting your head like, what does that mean? Like, there's no way that they're going to move everyone down there. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it makes sense for a company because Sega has been moving in more into licensing. Like, licensing is a big thing for Sega. And then the whole cartoon and trying to get more into Hollywood with the characters and things like that, it sort of made sense. That's a huge licensing. I mean, I don't know about you, but licensing is huge, and just the whole merchandising thing for Sega is huge, like, especially in Japan. As you guys know, how much merchandise we put out. It's a huge sort of group. And so it makes sense to be down in L.A. where all of the toy companies are at, all of the movie companies are at. And that was a big thing. So we just sat there kind of pondering, like, what was going to happen. But we kind of knew, I think, in the back of our heads that most people are probably not going to go down there because it doesn't make any sense. The most they're going to probably pay and ask a few people to come down there and restart, rebuild it there. But it doesn't make feasible sense to move an entire company down there.
Did you – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to ask, did you get any sort of or any – because when Sega acquired Atlus, I know, you know, eventually when companies – acquire another company, you know, they go through a time and then they look at, like, how can we best reorganize everything and really make best use of, you know, our assets, our people, and things like that. Did you see any sort of thing, like, you know, I think maybe further down the line, like, Sega of America is going to, you know, maybe consolidate more with Atlus, and now that they're moving down to LA, they're going to be, I think, very, very close, or if not next door to where Atlus is going to be at or is at. Do you think that maybe further down the line we're going to see some more of that consolidation within Atlus and things like that?
It's hard to say because, like, I mean, from a company perspective, Atlus and its parent company were so different from Sega. The way they did stuff, the way they handled – I mean, you think about it from a general basics of, like, approval process and just, like, internal approvals. And it's very different companies.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time to try to change groups around. And you sit there for a while and you figure out, like, well, who's doing it better, right? Who's doing it most effectively? And we never got to a point that it made sense for us to kind of come together and under one house. Like, they had a very specific way of doing stuff that was working really well for them, right? And we didn't – you're afraid to mess around with that, I think, a little bit. Just, you know, I would be afraid to mess around with that because, like, well, it's working for you guys. You're bringing over these niche titles that people are resonating with. You know, if we dive into that and we start applying our process or our larger scale publisher sort of requirements for that, that really – can mess things up. So I think Sega was really concerned about that. Sega Sammy was really concerned about that as a general philosophy. And I don't know what the plans are for the future as far as consolidation, but it just didn't really make sense that much to merge during the time I was at Sega. I don't think there are any really plans to, because both sides are on a different track, you know what I mean? And it would take a lot to kind of bring us all together. And in the end, we wouldn't even know if that would be a better off entity anyway.
Yeah, that's crazy. So one of the things that it through these round of layoffs, I mean, it really kind of hit the community management side pretty tough, didn't it? I mean, I know, you know, Kelly and you know just a lot of the guys that have been there for so long, Julian, they've all been, or most of them have been, like, go. I know that the mobile side of Sega of America seemed to be the ones that kind of stuck around. Can you shed some light on, like, what is the community team really like at this point post layoffs at Sega? Can you kind of explain that?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to clear is, like, it's like, you know, there's no hard date for sort of layoffs. I mean, they're constantly sort of evaluating stuff, and, you know, like, right now they're still in San Francisco. They haven't moved yet, right? So. Yeah. So until they move, whenever they end up doing that, because I don't think it's ever said, like, as far as exactly when they're going to move. You know, I assume by that time they would have the people who are not moving are going to be, you know, out of jobs or just moving on here in the Bay Area. And whatever number that is, I'm not exactly sure. But right. I think you're going to see – I expect more and more of people leaving in the months ahead – as they kind of come to decisions if they're going to SoCal or not. And I know that the community teams is a tough boat too, and I assume that they will be both going at some point, and I don't know when they're going. I can't remember what Kelly said as far as her when her last day is or when she plans to leave. But it's going to be tough for them too, right? I mean, I think about it from the standpoint, like, and I don't know what the plans are. Like, how are they going to handle community? Like, what are things going to, what's going to happen with the forums, right? Who's going to manage the forums? And do you think of that? Because I used to attend the forums, and I used to love that. And so I got to imagine that those guys are scrambling to try to set in place what's going to happen in the future after them. So I'm sure it's tough for them. I mean, they have to sort of, they're the face of the company in some ways, and they have to be happy and cheerful, and they have to portray that to the fan base, right? And say, no, no, we're still here. We're still here. Sega's going on. Don't worry, and things like that. So I assume it's got to be tough for them. And Sega will go on, but, you know, if you know that you're going to be leaving at some point, it's got to be tough to sort of portray that, you know, happy sort of atmosphere to them. So, but I would expect, from a gut instinct, I would expect that that a vast majority of the company probably won't go down to LA. You know what I mean? I just don't see that happening. A lot of people have been here for a long time, have houses, or doing whatever. So
it's tough to uproot, especially if you have a family. You know, your kids are in school. You know, you may be, you know, own a house and stuff like that. It's not an easy thing to just approve. I know, you know, at, you know, my organization I'm at right now, I mean, we moved from San Antonio all the way up into near Washington, D.C., and so there was, you know, very, very few people that made that transition, you know, from Texas to Maryland. So I can only, yeah, see that, and that is a tough thing, so.
Yeah, and man, a lot of – sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just – no, you know, go for it. I was just
– And it's like, I mean, I'm sure it's tough for people. Like I said, like a lot of people, you know, I hope some of them remain there if they can move. But a lot of people, there have been quite a few people who have been there for decades. You know, we talked about it earlier, but like I can't even imagine. And a lot of these people are just so dedicated to Sega and just such a wealth of knowledge. We had a guy in the development group who's been there since the Genesis days. And it's a huge thing to see him go. I mean, he says he's such the nicest guy, and he has so much history in his head. Like, almost like I hope he writes a book or something. He's probably not the kind of guy to do it, but he's seen the company go through so many changes, gone through so many hardware platforms, and he's the guy when I know quite a bit, but just like pulling out stuff and we're digging through things, like where is this from, and you know, and he'll generally be able to know where it is and what it's from and what its purpose was. You know, I remember like the I found a loose Game Gear to Game Gear cable, and I didn't instantly recognize it because it looked like the ports are pretty advanced. I don't know if you've ever seen that cable, but they're pretty advanced. I'm looking at it, I'm like, what is this? And I'm trying to, is it like, and I was trying to think, does the Nomad have a port? And I'm like, oh no, it had regular controllers. But he just looks at it right away and goes, oh, that's a Gear to Gear cable. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. it's sad to see him go. I'm hoping to have him, if I ever do a podcast, to have him on there, and we'll just talk about history of Sega as well and things. But it's got to be tough for these people. Imagine like being in a company for 20-odd years and then having to enter the workforce in a new job. Things have changed so much. Like, where would you begin, right? So best of luck to all those guys, and I hope everyone lands on their feet. But I'm sure it's going to be tough for those who have been there. I mean, I've been there like almost 9 years, and it's a tough change for me just from the standpoint like, wow, like things have changed so much. But for them, oh my gosh, I can only imagine.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
All right, well, I think we're going to switch gears to another topic here. And unfortunately, Timbo isn't the only elephant in the room today. So, Sonic Boom, what was your response to the fallout following Sonic Boom's release?
So, it was a weird thing. I mean, like, from a personal perspective, Sonic Boom was a weird thing, because obviously there's pros and cons of Sonic Boom. As a whole, and this is the thing, is like, for some reason, I think people still focus on just the game aspects of Sonic Boom, and that's rightfully so, because that's Sonic has always been the game sort of thing. But you also have to think about all the other things that we tried to do with Sonic. And the goal of Sonic Boom, as I've said over the last year or so, is to reach a larger audience with Sonic, to make him relevant again. There is a very loyal Sonic fan base, it's no doubt. But there's also no arguing that every year it gets smaller and smaller, and through whatever means. I mean, even if you had super high-budget AAA games and everything else every year, the install base is going to go smaller. Call of Duty's install base is going to shrink. And we see it for every other AAA major franchise. But so the attempt at Sonic Boom was to appeal to an audience that is not familiar with Sonic, or was fans of Sonic maybe previously but not fans anymore for whatever reason. And I think from that standpoint, it was a big success. I can say from that standpoint, the audience for the cartoon is really well, the licensing, because the toys are doing really well. I remember hearing or reading reports that, especially in the early days, the Sonic Boom toys were selling out at Toys R Us in like 24 hours. And was doing that for a while. It wasn't like just the fans. It was people who were looking for something new. I think that the classic Sonic, you know, the Genesis era Sonic and then the Sonic Adventure kind of Sonic, the redesign, people have seen it so much. And if you think about it from a manufacturer, right, or a licensor, they can only do so much with any character, right? Pac-Man or whatever. You can only do so much with the same character design or the same sort of premise and story over and over again.
Yeah.
So I expect, and it felt that way, that like I think people were really excited from that standpoint that, yes, oh my goodness, thank goodness. We have new characters, we have new vehicles, we have a new world. We're kind of starting fresh again, and it kind of injects a breath of fresh air into sort of their thinking process and their ability to go in a direction, right? Because they've been stuck in a certain way. Like, I don't know how many Chaos Emeralds you can make, how many, I mean, you know, you don't really see any vehicles. So think about it from that standpoint of how, and again, I say this not just for Sonic, but any sort of IP, how sort of stagnant it becomes and how limited it becomes as far as the different types of toys and licensing stuff. Like, how many times are you going to see Sonic on a t-shirt, any character t-shirt, you know, like pointing to himself or number right. one, or whatever, right? It's the same sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, and, you know, you'd have to talk to them in general, but I have a feeling from a perspective that the licensing partners were really excited and thankful for Sega trying something new with Sonic. And I know Archie did too. I mean, talking with Archie just as a casual fan, it's like they were like super excited about being able to do another comic for Sonic, because obviously Sonic has been around for a long time for their comics, for Archie. They're a big supporter. They're a huge fan of Sonic, and it's been great to work with them. But, you know, I could tell right away that when they were able to do a new comic book, a Sonic Boom comic, that they were, the writers and the artists were super excited. Everyone I talked to over there was really excited, again, because it's a new direction, a new potential. Since it's a Western-driven Sonic for the most part, you know, the potential of stories and things, of places to go, we're really excited. And the voice actors, too. I mean, you know, like little... I mean, you can't change the voice acting of Sonic or the other characters that much, but there's little nuances, right? And I think that they appreciate, again, I mean, I'm putting words in their mouth, but I think that they appreciated being able to try something a little bit different, right? Mm-hmm. And then having another character in the form of Styx add to the arsenal and kind of play against. And you know, for those who have been doing it for years, I think it's a breath of fresh air. And the cartoon's been doing really well. I mean, it's like there's so many... I know of so many people who have not had an interest, who don't play the games Sonic in the past and stuff, who now just arbitrarily watch the cartoons and have bought the toys because of the cartoons. I'm like, that's a huge success. I was walking down the street. I live relatively near a school, and I was walking by one time, and I was wearing a Sonic Boom. I can't remember if it was a T-shirt or something. And a guard, like a walking guard, said like, oh, hey, it's like, my daughter loves Sonic. She like watches it every weekend. And I'm like, oh, really? And I was asking like, you know, so, you know, she'd been a Sonic fan for a long time. It's like, no, only for like a little while, maybe like like half a year or something, you know? And I'm like, really? And I'm like, yeah, she's like, she like saw the cartoon. She loves Amy. She loves Amy in the cartoon. And I'm like, oh, wow. And I'm like, and it's like, and she just loves Sonic now, so she keeps asking me to like buy Sonic stuff at the store. And I'm like, really? I'm like, so that's what I say to people. Like that is one sort of classic case I walk across. But there's many numerous cases of people who have come into the Sonic world for the first time because of either the new toys or either the look of the characters, love it or not, or the cartoon. And that's why I consider that a big success. You know what I mean? So as an initiative, I consider, me personally, I consider Sonic Boom really cool. Could have been better? Yes. But there's so many different people you have to work with, and how many different – you think about all the like licensing partners and all the cartoon partners and figuring out where the cartoon's going to go in the world and who you have to negotiate. It's so much work. And,
yeah.
But the fact that it's a new – I think the fact that it's a new design for Sonic allowed us to get people excited and show, hopefully the cartoon will end up all around the world. And if it does, I think it's because, and I hate to say it, I think it's because of the new direction. I think it's because they feel, people feel that it's a new breath of fresh air for the character. It's not the same that it was in the past. And that's why they're showing it interest now. So I think in many ways it has helped Sonic. You know, going back to sort of the games, yeah, could the games always be better? Yes. Any game I worked on could be better. I have faults, major faults with every single game I've worked with, even ones that have rated highly, and even ones that are rated lowly. You know, I come across people who at Shinobi who love Shinobi, but I look at Shinobi and all I see are like issues and issues and issues and issues. I look at this that we didn't do, and I look at this, and yeah. But there's people who love it. And in the case of Sonic Boom Games, I see both. I see that we tried to do something different. I think the challenge is that if you think about it like this, and I can sum it like this, Sonic Team has been making Sonic for 20-odd years, right? They understand Sonic and little things that make a Sonic game. In a relatively short amount of time, we had to teach new teams what Sonic is all about. But not only – so if I were to say to a team like, okay, you've got – let's say, period, you just have to make a Sonic game, a speed-based Sonic game. Do it, right? They would have to start from zero, ground zero, and they would have to try to catch up to 24 years of experience in the length of a single development time. And that's just to create a basic Sonic game. Now imagine asking them, like, okay, you've got to reinvent Sonic. You've got to, like, try something different. You still got to try to capture the speed, but you've got to be different enough that when people look at it, it's a different sort of experience.
That was really hard to do.
Right? And it's really tough. And we had very ambitious goals. We really wanted to deliver on something that that people were excited about, that managed to capture the speed but also added new gameplay components. Because the thing that we kept hearing in focus tests all the time, it's like, oh, you know, it's all about speed all the time. It's all about speed all the time. It's like, I can't play Sonic anymore because it's too fast. I'm like, okay, well, then let's try to slow him down. Right. But that of course, pisses off people who like traditional Sonic games, right? Mm-hmm. And so you try to find a middle ground. Okay, let's try to have speed, but we also need this other stuff. And I think that sort of the failures of the game were like it being overly ambitious initially, and the fact that not only were we trying to make just a really good basic Sonic game, but we're trying to add more to it. And I think that our sort of reached, overextended our grasp in some ways. And did I learn a lot from that? Yes. But some things that I think came across really positive were like the co-op mode. I think really people, I kept hearing back, people really like that. And like the dual screen mode. And I think that hopefully that Sonic Team will think about doing in the future, that sort of co-op experience. You know, but I think the biggest sort of mistakes were just trying to cram too much into the game, and because of that, you're sort of scrambling to try to finish the game in a lot of ways. Right. And there's a reason why the Sonic games are relatively, you know, high quality, and but they're very basic, I think, in their design, right? There's a very simple core mechanic. You've got speed and running, you got platforming, you got homing attacks, right? Mm-hmm. And all enemies are defeated the same way and with the same thing. And because of that, and because Sonic have worked on that for so many years, they can fine-tune that, right? They can build a world around it that uses that stuff. And we're trying to add in a bungee mechanic, and we were adding in combat, and we were adding in puzzles, and we were adding in vehicles, and we're adding in hopefully a more compelling story, and a bunch of different environments, and it's just a lot, you know, it's a lot. Sure. I think that's the thing, and I think that if there's any lesson for me in general, and just something I'll take forward with me, is that being too ambitious is can be bad. And in the past, I've always tried to be ambitious. I've always tried to push development teams to get out of their safety box, because there's two ways to do development. There is teams who are really good about a schedule, and they will always hit their release date. But the product that you get is a safe product. It's solid, but it's never going to spark any sort of criticism or positive feedback, anything in any way. It's not going to elicit emotion or any sort of thing. And then there's other groups that either by their own way or by a producer pushing them to get out of their comfort zone, that you end up with a product, good or bad, that causes people to think about it, because there's some aspects of it that are different that you don't see or not. And I've always been sort of the producer who tries to push teams to exceed beyond what they're comfortable with or what's possible. I mean, I'll give you some examples. So one of my first games, early games, PSP, and I wasn't wasn't the greatest game ever, but it was Crazy Taxi Fair Wars. And some people hate that game. It's Crazy Taxi 1 and 2 on PSP. But what we wanted to do, and what I tried to push the team to do, which was extremely difficult, was to have online modes for that game. A game that was not designed by any means to have online modes, right? But I pushed the team, and we created some interesting online modes where people could play against each other in Crazy Taxi, which is, imagine taking that old source code and trying to do something with that, right? So that's one thing. In Universe of War was a RTS that I did with Petroglyph, who are great RTS guys. And I'm like, okay, you know what? You're a PC guy. We're doing this for 360. Let's allow PC gamers to play against 360. And everyone's like, what? And the only company that had been able to do that before is Microsoft, and they did it on a server side where both games talk to a server. We had to do it peer-to-peer. So a PC had to connect to a 360 and just interact with each other. No one has ever done. No one still has ever done it. But we felt that we could do it, so I tried to push the team to do that, and we were able to do it. And so I'm always trying to push the team out of their comfort zone to try to do something that's bigger, that will wow people or interest people. And sometimes it works out, and sometimes it doesn't. But I think really what happened with Sonic Boom is that we tried to take a character that has evolved over 20-odd years into a very tight experience, and we didn't ask them just to make a version of that. We asked them to make a version of that plus all this other stuff, and I think that in hindsight was just a lot to ask of any development team. And so I guess in learnings, that is something that I'll keep in mind in the future. But I'll continue to push teams, because that's where greatness comes out of, you know. And the story that I come up with, that I remember, is that in God of War, so the first God of War, which people hail as like an amazing game, right? But most people know that for a lot of people on the team, that was their very first job in the video games industry, and for them, it was their last job in the video games industry. So that game tore through a lot of people, and there were a lot of bodies by the wayside by the end of it. But you know what? It was an amazing game, right? And it sparked a new IP, and there's no one that argues that from a quality perspective, that God of War isn't an amazing series. It's amazing. But it took a lot of casualties along the way. And that's because Jaffe like pushed people to the end to try to deliver on something high end. Fortunately, he had the resources of Sony and all this other stuff, right? Mm. But you know, it's a lot of people kind of get close, but they just don't quite get over that hump to get to what is amazing experience. And I was trying to deliver on experience that would just, you know, I love the Sonic fanbase. I want to deliver on experience that makes people proud and happy. But I was also tasked with creating experience that appeals to a larger audience that doesn't necessarily play Sonic. And in a lot of ways, those go against each other. I had to err on the side of trying to appeal to a newer audience. And it was tough. It was tough.
What do you think would have had to have happened, how would it have been possible to kind of realize that vision of that, you know, that Sonic game that you were aiming for? Like, what more could have happened? Do you think just more time would have helped, or what do you think?
I think the biggest thing is that time, I don't think, would have helped, because, you know, you're on this path and you've already got this game. It would have maybe been tighter or more polished and stuff, but it's still the experience. I think what would have benefited this game, and this is across many games, that if you could have gone back in time and during the early conceptual stages and pre-production, focused on different things. So I would have like reduced features probably, and I would have had the team focus on speed from the very get-go. So, you know, we were concerned that speed was something that was the last thing that people sort of wanted, because we kept hearing that they were tired of speed. They want, like, something else. And so I think at least from my perspective, we put speed on the shelf for a little too long, and we focus on other stuff like co-op and things like that. And I would have made the team, in hindsight, I would have made the team focus on speed at the beginning and try to nail the feeling of that, and then let that permeate into all the other gameplay features that we're building versus the other way around. I think most people play the game, I think they had the feeling that speed feels kind of tacked on in some ways. I feel that too, and I think that's just because we weren't focused on that as a key thing. Because speed is always a Sonic thing, right? Sonic does speed well. I'm like, we need to make sure that all these other things are done well. So I think if I could go back in time, I would have gone back and changed the things that we focused on and the number of things that we focused on back in the day. But it would have been hard. This was a very ambitious project. It was a cartoon, a new toy line, and many other things tied with it. We had to aim large. We had to aim big. And that's, you know, part of the things. I would have kept things a little bit tighter. I would have simplified a few things, and kind of gone from there. But there's definitely a lot of lessons and learnings from it. But regardless, even if I could gone back in time and change what I was, at the end of the day, it might have been a better game, but I don't think that people who are traditional Sonic fans still would have loved it. They wouldn't have enamored for it as they did for like Generations or whatever games that they love in recent history, because it wouldn't have been that game. It wasn't the goal of that game. The goal of the game was, like I said, was to reach other people. And I think in some ways, in many ways, it did. And it could have done better if everything was at a higher level of polish and stuff. Yes. But for what it is, as a branch of Sonic and a new initiative by Sega, I think it was wholeheartedly a success in many ways.
Yeah, you laid out a lot of reasons for and some of the successes it made. You do a really good job also just kind of keeping, you know, your finger on the pulse of, you know, like what people are, you know what people are saying, about the franchise and reading, you know, stories here and there. I'm sure you saw some of the the stories that came out about like how Sega should put, you know, Sonic on the shelf for a while and you know, those kind of stories, which are insane. I mean, that's the dumbest thing Sega could ever do, is just, you know, put, say, Sonic away, you know, for 5 to 10 years. It'd be insane. But say, you know, you had, you know, the full reins of the Sonic franchise. What do you think, like, where do you think Sonic needs to go, like, in the future? And, like, what do you think would be, like, the best Sonic game? And you know, kind of how do you see the franchise playing out, like, in the next generation of consoles and stuff?
That's a tough one, right? Because, like, when you have a speed-based... the problem with Sonic is... you have to build a lot of content, right? When speed is your number one thing, you have to build so much content. And you have to spend so much time building content that a lot of things you don't have the time and resources to worry about. I mean, imagine any game, Mario or anything, if you're running as fast as Sonic, right? Think about the reason that Mario has just as simple mechanics as Sonic, but he moves so much slower. You have less level size and less real estate to build, and they can make sure that what they build is so tight, right? Sonic's case, you have to build just from a square one sort of situation. You have to build so much content, and then you got to worry about that every inch of that is super high quality. It's impossible to do, right? I think it's an insurmountable task to do that. So, but as far as what I would do, if I were to create, if I could have the option to make a new game, I would probably make a Sonic Adventure 3 type game. I would choose a few characters with very key gameplay abilities and have levels dedicated to them so that you could build Sonic levels and have them be perfect sort of Sonic levels. And then I would try to come up with compelling experiences for the other three characters and have those levels specifically built for them so that you can have your favorites for sure, but you wouldn't have to build an environment that suits multiple characters. Because I do think the multiple characters, I think that resonated well with people. I think in the end that people love playing the multiple characters. And I think that having a solo Sonic game, I just don't know how long that can last, you know, just like by himself. I just don't think there's enough variety there to sustain it. So I think what you need to do is flesh out some of the other characters, really think about their abilities and make their abilities compelling, and then build environments for them to go around and have fun in as well, and then make sort of an epic kind of adventure that way. That would be my ideal. If I could be carte blanche and make my own kind of game, that's what I would do. But I don't know. I think the future of Sonic needs to be in like co-op. I think that resonated really well with Sonic Boom, so I think you need that. I think you need to have some of that community or online play that's meaningful. Because I think that's what sustains a lot of these games these days. It's the interaction with friends to keep it going. So the one thing that I have always wanted to build, which I don't know if Craig is ever going to build, is a, even for mobile, but a level design, a level builder for Sonic.
Yes.
So, right? Everyone asked for that, and it's basically a really just a art-heavy sort of thing. You'd have to build lots and lots of assets. But imagine, even for like a 3DS game, if you had that, and Street Pass, and you had rare situations, like if you went to Comic-Con, you could get this rare piece that you could use to build part of your track that is only available at Comic-Con, or things
that'd
like that.
Amazing.
And,
yeah.
And people could trade and pieces, and then you could have leaderboards that you, whatever course you build, I can try to challenge your leaderboard times. Like, who would want, I mean, I think that's like, would be a great
idea. I think
idea.
That's one of the ones, yeah, I think we actually discussed that a while back on just how amazing, like a Sonic the Hedgehog, like, you know, level design game would be, and yeah, I would absolutely love that. And also, I mean, just from like even a if you wanted to look at it from the business standpoint of just like putting in some like microtransactions where you buy like little pieces or things like that, yeah. Maybe like different color palettes and things like that. I think that would be really cool. I would 100%.
Yeah, and I say because like, you can't. Sonic fans don't know that what people feel is a perfect Sonic game is different for all Sonic fans. So here's your chance to just build. What is your perfect Sonic game? Like, build the level, build the environment, you know, and have fun that way. So I think that's another thing that Sega could hopefully do in the future that I think would resonate really well with fans, for sure. But I think in general, for the franchise in general, I think you need to really do multiplayer, and I think you need to add in online and sort of community aspects so that friends can play with each other and that the community could come together over a game and actually interact together in that way, and that would hopefully sustain and keep the interest in the franchise alive.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm sorry, I think I muted Blake. Are you there, Blake? I didn't mean... Let's see.
He's probably yelling at you now.
I know. Let me see. How do I unmute?
I'm upstairs.
There we go. Okay,
here.
There, Blake? I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm sorry
here.
About that, buddy.
That's
sorry
okay.
That.
Okay, I did have one last... it should be... A quick answer, maybe even just yes or no question, back on the Sonic Boom topic. So Sonic Boom, when it was released, was pushed forward a week. Now, I'm sure it's not enough time to do really any Q&A or anything like that, but my question is, what was the reason why it was pushed forward? Was that to tie it more to the show being launched? Or what? My theory has always been it was pushed forward to get it out of the way of Smash Brothers.
You know, I would say that probably a little bit both. I mean, you remember this was a deal with Nintendo, and Sega had titles that were coming out, Nintendo had titles that were coming out, and then also the cartoon ended up launching, you know, at the beginning of that month, right? So it made sense from a, I think, a practical standpoint to try to get, you know, ideally, you know, the game originally was going to come out sort of earlier and try to match up with the cartoon or get people to play the game and then watch the cartoon or vice versa and things like that. So I think, you know, I don't think there's one specific answer to that. I think it's a multiple things. I think if people were like, okay, the cartoon ended up coming out at the beginning of the month, you've got titles from Nintendo, and you got titles, but you know, it was never a sweet spot because I think the same week Assassin's Creed came out, you know, and yes, it's a different market, but people are so focused on one game for a week sort of thing. And so I think Assassin's Creed was the big thing that week as well. So there was not, you know, when you're in November, when you're in the holiday time frame, there's never a sweet month. Sweet week or time period, right? It's all packed with titles. So I think from the virtue, and I think from that standpoint, I can't remember, but I don't even think when we made that decision that we even knew when Smash Brothers was coming out. I don't think Nintendo had said or anything, and I can't be for sure, but it's not like because we're a partner, Nintendo shares with us their release dates and stuff.
Yeah.
So honestly, I can't remember for sure, but I don't think personally I was even aware that Smash Brothers was coming out that week when we moved it. I think we decided to move it before we even knew what was coming out that week. And it was more about just like other factors like the cartoon. I think possibilities of other titles coming out from different publishers as well, and we were just trying to adjust it accordingly. And we also had that weird situation that we had the week split between the handheld version and the console version, and we're trying to resolve that, I think, to a degree as well in some manner. So I think there, I don't think there's one answer to that. I think there's a multiple factors. But to answer about your Smash Brothers, from my recollection, I don't even think we knew when Smash Brothers was coming out when we adjusted that date.
Hmm.
Okay. Very interesting. Yeah, that's always been my conjecture in my own mind, so it's good to have.
Yeah, I mean,
that's watered down.
Yeah, I don't think Nintendo would really, even partners, which just because there's so much, I mean, especially Smash Bros. Being such a huge title, I think they hold everything close to their chest. I don't think they're going to share a release date for that game until they absolutely have to share a release date for that game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Steven, I want to know, because, I mean, you've done a lot, like, in the industry up to this point in your career. I mean, you were, you know, in the journalism side for a long time, and then you've moved into the production side and everything and produced several titles. You know, at this point, like, what do you want to do now? I mean, if you, you know, like, where do you see yourself going? Do you want to stay, like, in the gaming industry, or are you looking to do something else? Or, you know, like, if it were entirely, like, yeah, you know, up to you, like, what do you want to, I guess, accomplish, you know, going forward?
It's tough. I mean, I obviously want to stay in the games industry. I love the games industry. I love trying to learn from my mistakes and create better experiences. And I just enjoy, I mean, it's kind of cheesy, but I enjoy, like, seeing people's reactions to playing games, like, you know, mm-hmm, the kids or whoever's playing it. And, you know, I still get, you know, emails and just stuff about different games that I've developed in the past. And as I do these videos, people now say, like, oh, you worked on this, or you worked on this. Like, I had, like, a bunch of people, because I worked on a game, PC game, back in the day at Dynamics called the Hunter Hunted, which I didn't think went anywhere. But apparently, I had, like, four people contact me and say, oh, my gosh, I loved Hunter Hunted. I played that to death on the PC. I'm like, really? And I'm like, you know? And so I think as people see some of the stuff I worked on, they see sort of the breadth and the range of things that I've participated in and stuff, and while, you know, these last year or so I've been known as the sort of Sonic guy, I've worked on, you know, a large variety of different things. So but where I'd want to go, I still want to create games for sure. But it's a little tough because at companies like Sega and some of the ones I've been worked in the past, you know, I've had a little bit more flexibility in my role. I've been able to provide, like, creative feedback. I've been able, like, in the case of Sonic Boom, it was amazing because, you know, I participated in everything from, like, the character redesigns to decisions made on the cartoon to the toy, you know, approving, like, aspects of the toys and being able to provide creative feedback on the games. And, you know, that's not something that one person general in the industry gets to do. That just never happens. You know, you're normally, like, tied, like, a producer in general is a schedule person, you know, and a lot of companies, if you go in as a producer, you are the schedule guy and you don't do creative freedom. That's the purview of the design team, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a tough thing. Like, I definitely want to do games, but I have a lot of just experience in creative feedback and just game design stuff, and hopefully I can land in a job that's similar to Sega and similar to Activision, that I was allowed to participate in design work and stuff, because I do think, honestly, that I make the stuff better from my experience. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely want to do those games. In some ways, I wouldn't mind working on some more simpler titles to get back to my grassroots and just understanding what makes a good game at its core level. But I there is something cool about working on these bigger titles and trying to get them out there to see what people think about. But definitely staying in games. I'm not sure yet where I'm gonna land up. You know, I'm interested in, like, the virtual reality stuff, so I want to talk to, like, see if I can meet up some people from, like, Facebook on the Oculus Rift or, like, Project Morpheus. Cool. Because I honestly, if I had a choice right now, I think that making some games for those things would be very interesting. It's at the forefront of the technology, and I have some cool ideas. So I don't know. If I had a choice right now, I would love to work on something new like that. That would be pretty cool.
That would be awesome. Just like, really groundbreaking stuff. Like, that's going to be, that's, like, the next,
yeah,
big, you know, like, kind of thing coming in gaming.
One
of the things that Sega and Capcom recently announced was the Worlds Unite, crossover comic. I don't know if you're a big comic guy, but what did you think of all that?
I think that's cool. I mean, I think it's always exciting when people cross over. When we had that, you know, we had Mega Man Sonic previously mm-hmm. in the comic books, that was huge. I think that really grabbed a lot of new readers, and I think it's any case where in any sort of medium where you have this crossover, when you have like Marvel and DC crossover, or character, you know, how big was the news when like even though it's the same universe, like Marvel came over to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? Spider-Man came over to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? Yeah. It's like huge. Uh-huh. It's like people love these crossover things, so I think it can only be good for both groups, and I hope that the interest in Mega Man and his appearance and stuff helps convince Capcom to bring him back in some meaningful way again. You know, it's unfortunate the things that have happened and sort of led to the sort of Mega Man kind of falling by the wayside, but I think it's a character that can be reinvented very well, and I think that there could be some cool ideas that came out of that, and a Mega Man adventure game would just be phenomenal. I think people would love that, you know. But again, as with Sonic, it's like, how do you reinvent that character in an interesting and meaningful way and appeal to people who might not have grown up on Mega Man? But I think that character has a lot of potential. So I hope they see the interest in him, and I hope you see more and more Mega Man showing up in different areas, and hopefully that sparks the creation of a new title. So.
I think it really opens up a lot of fun possibilities with interaction between Sonic and Alex Kidd. Really interested to see, like, hopefully they'll make some a few like jokes and stuff between them. I think that would be awesome. I'm a huge Alex Kidd fan, and I've been saying like for years now. I would love to see just a new, even like a little indie style Alex Kidd game set inside like the old style of. Miracle World or something like that. Just even
that would be awesome.
DC remaster would be great. But I absolutely love me some Alex Kidd. But yeah, you know, I think it's gonna do it, Steve. I know we've been on for almost 2 hours now, so I don't want to take up too much more of your Sunday. I want you to be able to go. There's probably lots of retro games out there just waiting for you to go find them. You won't be able to have the luxury of just going in a box and getting them for free like you did at Sega. You actually have to spend some money.
I know.
Like regular Joes out there.
Yeah, for sure. But it's cool, and it gives me time to actually go back and appreciate, you know, have time in the day to do that and try new games and kind of remember what sort of made these old games meaningful and you know, great to play. So it's been a great just, like, lesson, just, like, kind of going through them and see what clicked and what was good about stuff. Because, you know, most of my experience was from the editorial days. I played so many games, and I learned so much about design and things just from playing sheer quantity of games and writing about them and analyzing them. And I've tried to do that constantly throughout my career in development, but it's hard because there's only so many games in the day, so many hours in the day. So now I have a chance to kind of go back and look at some of these gems that I haven't really touched for very long and see, like, what makes this game great and kind of add that to the, you know, the knowledge base and stuff like that. So I think wherever I end up, in the future, hopefully I'll be full of new ideas and a new sort of fresh perspective on stuff and be able to create something that folks will really enjoy and love. So we'll see where it goes. But I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah, we're really interested to see, you know, where you go from here. We're obviously going to be kind of following your career just as kind of fans and stuff of, you know, the work you've done over the years. So we definitely... you know, see you bouncing back real quick, and it's going to be interesting to see where you go, because it'll be really cool stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah, I hope so. We'll see. I'll keep you guys updated, and hopefully I'll be able to do more of these, pop in for a little while at least in some of these, more of these podcasts and stuff like that. So we'll see what the future has in store.
Awesome.
Sweet.
And once again, your YouTube, they can find you. It's Frostman007 on YouTube.
Yep.
And I think that's your Twitter as well, right?
Yeah, everything I do is pretty much Frostman007. So I'm sure if you search in any Instagram, it's Frostman007. Snapchat is Frostman007. So, you can find me anywhere on using those that name.
And, and thank you for explaining to me yesterday what Snapchat was.
I'm still learning. I don't even know. I don't really look at it that much, but it's like I wanted to explore just because so many people use it, like a huge quantity of people. But it's tough because when you're juggling all these other social media things, it's like another thing. And I just don't know, well, what should I do on Snapchat versus this or this? And so I kind of forget about it because it seems like too much work. And But it is interesting. I don't know. I mean, obviously there's something to it because so many people use it, but I don't know. Like I said to you, I think we're just too old for it. It's a younger...
I think that's what it is. I think that's what it is. Because, yeah, I look at that, and I see it's like this new thing, and it's like, do I really want to spend the time to like learn why I should be using this other thing when my Twitter and my Facebook work just fine, and I end up sounding like an old fogey.
Yeah, so. Yeah. No worries. Well, you know, times are changing, so you got to adapt. But I think I'll stick with Twitter and YouTube and that stuff.
I'm going to stick with MySpace.
MySpace. You're going to be like the last person left on MySpace.
That's why it's mine.
Yeah. That's true.
I'll go to Ask Jeeves.
Ask Jeeves.
All right. And Steven, we always love having you on, so hopefully we'll be able to do this again. And I'm going to go now back and watch your Engage unboxing after this because I'm really, really interested in that. So once again, thanks for coming on, and we'll have you again back soon. This is going to do it for the show. Take it easy, everyone.
Yep, bye.
Bye-bye.
Sonic N, now on Engage. Thank you.